Today on the John Ankerberg Show, the secular attack on Christianity. How can Christians defend their ideas and beliefs in a hostile world? Christians comprise 84% of the country. Another 7% of Americans have other religious beliefs. Why should those who make up less than 10% of the country be allowed to banish, talk about God, intelligent design, and morals in our public schools? Why is there a war on Christmas in the public square? Why do secularists want to take God out of the Pledge of Allegiance? And why is it politically incorrect for government leaders and candidates for the Supreme Court to talk about their belief in God? Today, my guests for this debate are atheist Dr. Paul Kurtz, author of Humanist Manifesto 2, and Christian philosopher and author Dr. Norman Geisler. We invite you to join us.
Welcome. Tonight we're talking about secular humanism, and my guests are Dr. Paul Kurtz, the man who drafted the Humanist Manifesto 2 and a secular humanist declaration. He's also the editor of the main secular humanist magazine in America called The Free Inquiry. And he's also professor of philosophy at the State University of New York at Buffalo. Also, Dr. Norman Geisler from Dallas Theological Seminary, an Orthodox Christian who has authored many books on philosophy and theology. Gentlemen, we're glad that you're here tonight. Is there any rational justification for being a humanist? Is one of the questions we want to ask Paul. And Dr. Geisler, is it more or less rational for a person to hold to biblical Christian beliefs? And Paul, I'd like to start in a different area tonight, and that would be of looking at a quick definition here of a secular humanist. Okay, now instead of giving the Humanist Manifesto 1 and 2 here, let me just give you a brief one, because we're going to go through different points of the manifestos here. Sir Julian Huxley, okay, gave us a brief definition. He says, "I use the word humanist to mean someone who believes that man is just as much a natural phenomenon as an animal or a plant, that his body, mind, and soul were not supernaturally created, but are products of evolution, and that he is not under the control or guidance of any supernatural being or beings, but has to rely on himself and his own power." Is that a pretty good summary?
I think that's a very good definition. I would add other things as well to that definition.
And I'm going to let you as we go along, so don't worry about that. But let me come. You know, as I've been reading Sartre and Nietzsche and so on, each one of them, in their atheism, okay, there was a point in their life. And I'm going to ask that you would be kind of open and personal with us. And by the way, I want you both to speak from the bottom of your heart. We're going to disagree. I know that ahead of time, okay? But we can be friends. And I really enjoy the friendship of both of you men on stage. And I think that you'll get along terrific together as well. But sometimes we can be such good friends that we do not really tell the people out in television land what our constituents back home really want us to say, okay? So we're going to be friendly, but I don't want you to pull any punches, okay? Paul, in terms of these men like Nietzsche and Sartre and so on, in their life there was a time when they crossed over the line and they left God out of their life and they became an atheist. Let me ask you point blank, are you an atheist?
I can prefer to call myself a skeptic. I'm an unbeliever. I've examined the arguments all during my life as a philosophy professor for the existence of God, all the evidence. I can find insufficient support. That's why I'm a skeptic. I don't know whether or not God exists. I cannot find sufficient reasons to believe in God.
So you'd be an agnostic.
I like the term skeptic. I'm not unwilling to say that I'm an atheist. That may shock some of the people here, but I'm not unwilling to say that. But a more sophisticated position is, as a skeptic, namely, I'm open-minded, I'm seeking and looking for the truth,
right,
and I don't find sufficient support for the claim that God exists.
Right. You know, there's two kinds of agnostics. There's the ornery agnostic and the ordinary agnostic. You know what the difference is on that one, don't you, Paul?
No, what is the difference?
Yeah. Ornery agnostic says, I don't know, but I know you don't know either. And you're not one of those, are you?
No, I consider myself an extraordinary
Okay, but the ordinary agnostic simply says, I don't know, but if you got some evidence, I want to look for it. I want to see, I want to test it. And I think that's where you're coming from. Yes. That's why I enjoy the friendship here. As a philosophy professor, though, you also know that when you're talking about unbelief, it's philosophically impossible to prove a universal negative, namely if there is no God. I mean, it's a crummy position when you try to prove it. Another way of saying that would be, for our people that are listening in, is that if you got product A and product B over here, and you got two salesmen that are going at it, okay? Salesman A can knock down product B and all that it's for, and he can do a terrific job, knock the ball over the fence, and nobody will buy his product because he hasn't said a word about why you ought to buy his product. All he's done is torn down the other case. Okay? Before we start talking about Christianity and Orthodox Christian belief, tell me, what is it that you do believe and the proof for it?
Well, let me say first that if my little daughter asked me, does Santa Claus believe, maybe I can't disprove it. We can go to the North Pole and she can say, Daddy, he's in the South Pole. And we go down there, maybe somewhere else. So it's difficult to prove the negative, as you point out. On the other hand, I don't accept the existence of Santa Claus except in a kind of mythological framework. I have no objection to the myth or the fairy tale. But the question is, if Santa Claus exists, I want evidence for it. Okay, I'm a secular humanist. I believe in the human potentiality. I believe that we ought to develop a good life here and now, that we ought to use our best intelligence to try to solve human problems, to build a good society, and to do what we can to alleviate human suffering. For me, the end of the good life is creative enjoyment, creative fulfillment, shared experience with other people in a good society.
Okay. I appreciate that thought, but if I was to come back and ask for more proof and say, if you were to talk to our audience and Dr. Geisler sitting there next to you, if somebody were to say this statement, it's in a book that I read, that atheism is false for several reasons. Number one, it's philosophically inadequate, scientifically erroneous, morally bankrupt, socially destructive, aesthetically impotent, and humanly degrading. Start with number one. Give me the philosophical evidence why you would say you hold on to naturalism, because you got to hold on to naturalism if there is no God, right?
Well, atheism means, I prefer the term non-theism, because I don't think the notion of a theistic being, that God is a person, I don't think that's entirely intelligible. In one sense, it's a confused or a meaningless concept to talk about a transcendent being who exists. In any case, when you look for the support, you ask people why they believe, what are the evidence, what is the reason they seem to be insubstantial. So yes, I'm a naturalist. Namely, I believe there's a universe out there, and I want to understand it. And the methods that I will use are the methods of experience and reason, primarily based upon the sciences. So humanism, I think, is the best expression of modern science. It's the scientific outlook, using the rigorous methods of the scientific inquiry in order to test hypotheses about nature.
Okay. Dr. Geisler, you've been sitting there for a little bit. Let me get you in here. And that is, do you think that skepticism, atheism, is philosophically inadequate today concerning the scientific evidence and the view of the world?
Well, I agree with Paul that we need to be rational, we need to be scientific, but when I look at the scientific evidence, it leads to a belief in God. For example, the Big Bang Theory, by three lines of converging evidence, the expanding universe, the radiation echo, and the second law of thermodynamics, all lead scientifically to prove that the universe had a beginning. Now, one of the fundamental rational laws of all thought, and Paul is a rationalist, he wants to be rational, that's why I enjoy dialoguing with him, is that every event, everything that comes to be, has a cause. Now, if the universe came to be, then it's only rational to conclude that the universe had a cause. Let me illustrate by a story of two men, an atheist and a theist, who went for a walk in the woods. They came on a translucent ball, a glass ball about 8 feet in diameter, and the theist said to the atheist, where'd it come from? He said, I don't know, but somebody must have put it here. It just didn't pop into existence out of nowhere. They both agreed. And the theist said, what if the ball is 16 feet in diameter? Does it still need a cause? Said, yeah, if little balls need causes, big ones need causes too. And he said, what if the ball is as big as the whole world? The atheist paused and said, well, yeah, if little ones need causes, then big ones need causes, and really, big ones need causes too. Then he said, what if the ball is as big as the whole universe? atheist said, of course it doesn't need a cause, it's just there. That's not rational.
What do you think, Paul?
Well, you said, Norman, that every event has a cause. You maintain that. Every event has a cause. Is that what you said?
That's exactly right. Everything
okay.
that comes to be
All
has
right.
a cause.
Then you say the universe has a cause, and I take it that you would say that God caused the universe. And my question then is, if every event has a cause, what caused God?
Well, see, you just confused the statement. Everything that comes to be has a cause. God didn't come to be, so he doesn't need a cause. Just as the atheist believes...
You contradicted your notion that
no,
everything
I didn't. Let
has
me finish.
Cause.
Just as the atheist believes that the universe is eternal, often, and therefore didn't need a cause, if you can have an uncaused universe, we can have an uncaused cause. God, what sauce for the goose is sauce for the gander.
No, I don't know that the universe... I wouldn't say necessarily the universe is uncaused.
If it's
I think
caused,
there,
then there must have
I
been a cause
I think that
beyond
there,
it,
are,
right?
there, are cause, there are causes. Now, you have the Big Bang... The hypothesis in contemporary physics and cosmology that takes us back only to a point, but what caused the matter at that time before it exploded? So that you
no,
can't
stop. That's
not stop.
What the Big Bang
you
does. The Big Bang hypothesis says that the very matter of the universe came into existence 10 to 20 billion years ago. That when you take it back to a point, you reach a time where you have no space, no time, and no matter. You have literally nothing.
Well, we cannot say.
Robert,
we cannot say.
Even agnostics, Robert Jastrow in his book, God and the Astronomers, says that it came into existence out of nothing some billions of years ago. Now, if it came to be, and every event that comes to be needs a cause, then the universe needs a cause, too.
Well, I don't want to talk about the universe. You have many divergent... lines of causality and many kind of events happening.
What's wrong
but
with
you
the
can't,
universe?
You can't, you're leaping beyond it.
No, no, what's wrong with the universe and talking about the whole show, what Sagan calls the cosmos?
You have
Everything
the cosmos, was, but you have many,
is,
things, you have many things happening in the cosmos. Physics only takes you up to a point. What happened before that point? Now, if everything has a cause,
well,
then God
your,
must have a cause.
That's your question. No, no, see.
But you make an exception to the
your,
point that everything has a cause.
It's not an exception.
You're
the
only
rule,
pushing your ignorance one back.
Oh, no, it
step
isn't. You're
back.
Missing the point. You're not listening to it. Every event, everything that comes to be has a cause. That's the principle. The universe came to be, therefore the universe has a cause. Now, if God always existed, he didn't come to
he
be,
did not
he doesn't need
be.
A cause.
I see. Well, you're defining the situation, you're assuming your case by definition.
Not at all. The rational
Because you're defining,
person,
you say, how do you know that God did not come to be? How do you know that?
We know that the universe came to be.
Well, how do you know that God did not come to be?
And we know that everything that comes to be had a cause.
Well, how do you know that God did not come to be?
Because everything that comes to be has a cause. And if he caused the universe to come to be, he couldn't
by
have come
definition,
to be.
By definition, you're defining, not you're trying to define what you want to prove.
By the law of
How
rationality.
Do you know?
The law of rationality
That's
says
not
every,
rational. That's
everything
an assumption.
That comes, oh, you don't believe that.
Well, how do you know? Wait, how
oh,
do you
oh,
know?
Okay, okay, okay. Let me.
it's a rational assumption.
Let's start it, out with a couple of things
we're irrational saying. Assumption.
Irrational of, assumption well, say things have causes?
Well, let's
well,
wait,
how
wait,
do you
wait. Norman, Paul, hold it here. I want to ask one question. What is the evidence scientifically that the universe has not always been here? Start with.
Well, I don't know whether the... I really don't... I said I was a skeptic. I don't know whether the universe was here not was or was not here, you say. I don't know that it came into being at a certain point. It seems to me you're leaping
All right.
beyond the
I,
evidence.
I can take that, Paul, but let me
thesis.
Ask you this. It seems like that you're always pushing the Christians in your magazine rationally and on the scientific evidence. Let me do the same to you, okay? And that is, what do you do with the scientific evidence of the second law of thermodynamics in relationship to what is here?
Well, it doesn't say anything about beyond the range of observation, and now you're leaping beyond the range of observation. You're only pushing your ignorance back one step. You have the universe. You want to explain it, and so you introduce an unintelligible, inexplicable being, a divine being, to explain it. That only...
Oh, Paul,
that only
I didn't do any of that. All I said...
Well,
you missed my point, too. All I said is that it seems like if we're scientific, we're working with what is observational and repeatable. Well, we can't
yes.
do that, so we have to work with what we do have here.
Yes.
Okay? What we do have here are heat laws. We do have energy laws.
Yes.
Okay? We do have that.
Yes.
Okay? Using just what I do have, not what you don't know, but what I do have, let's be rational on that.
But
what conclusion would you come to?
You're jumping beyond what you have. You're jumping beyond the
but
laws
I gotta
of
start
physics,
with what
beyond
I've got,
observation, and you're postulating an unintelligible, unknown being who you said always
well,
existed
let's not,
and did
let's
not come
postulate
into being.
Anything about unknown yeah. being. Let's just take the logical conclusion that the second law of thermodynamics brings us to, namely that the universe had to have a beginning.
I don't see where that necessarily happens.
Well, it most certainly does. And
had
even
to have a beginning.
Agnostics
or
atheists.
An end.
Okay,
your
let's let Norman explain
that.
Why. Norman, let's slow down.
In his book, Five Ways, the British atheist Anthony Kinney says, the Big Bang Theory holds that the universe came into existence. So, as the atheist, he said, I'd have to conclude that the universe came into existence from nothing and by nothing. Now, you talk about ultimate irrationality. They used to criticize us as theists for believing that someone made something out of nothing, ex nihilo creation, and left. Now they believe no one made something out of nothing. Ha ha.
Well, I deny the notion that the universe came into being ex nihilo, out of nothing. You're leaping beyond
then
the evidence.
Then it's eternal. Then you have something that's
it
not
seems
caused.
To me it's,
which you just told me a moment ago is irrational to believe that something was uncaused like God.
No, it seems to me that it's not any less intelligible to say that
why
the universe
is irrational
was
for you
eternal.
To believe the universe is uncaused and irrational for me to believe that God is uncaused.
Because you think you're explaining what's happening in the universe, but you're not explaining it. You're reading in an item of faith.
We're certainly not explaining it if you say there's no cause.
I say as a skeptic, let's examine physics. Now, in physics, the Big Bang Theory makes sense. You're going far beyond physics. You're introducing something. You're introducing an intelligent being who has created the universe. This is unobservable. You've not tested it.
Okay, let me slow it down here. So you're saying that the universe does have a beginning via the Big Bang and second law of thermodynamics, but you will say you don't know what caused it. And when Geisler says that God caused it, okay, now we have to simply say we weren't there. We can't say we all can check it out and scientifically repeat it. So number one is both theories, okay, are not factual in the sense that we can go back there and scientifically repeat it. So anybody that says that evolution is a fact, we got to throw that out, right?
No, that's
away.
Something else. That doesn't follow. You sneak that in. Evolution is quite independent of this point, you say. I don't know that the universe has a beginning. All that I'm saying, and I think all that we can say, is that in contemporary physics, the Big Bang Theory is a useful hypothesis. But you're going far beyond that. You're bringing in theology. You're going beyond science.
Well, I didn't think I brought anything in except the scientific law and drew a conclusion.
Well, it's a conclusion that I questioned the conclusion.
On what basis scientifically do you question that conclusion?
I question the notion. When you talk about a cause, you talk about certain antecedent conditions that you can observe. And then you test the hypothesis. But when you talk about God as being the cause...
Okay, I didn't say anything about God yet. Okay, Norman's been saying that.
God, the cause of the universe,
yeah, but I just want to get to this one point, Paul, and that is that it seems awfully interesting to me that using just science, okay, the second law of thermodynamics, which says that the universe had to have a beginning because if it was eternal, it would have already run down and we'd all be sitting here in an ice box, okay?
Well,
so
we're
not,
down.
Obviously, it had to have a beginning and apparently recently. Now, that's there. I haven't snuffed God
recently,
at all. All we have to do is say,
John,
now, what cause are we talking about for that? You're saying
you
don't know.
John, how recent are you talking about? What are you talking about? How recent?
I'm not talking about anything. I'm simply coming to that
10,
conclusion.
Years?
No, I'm just taking a conclusion.
15 billion years?
10 to 20 billion years.
10 to 20 billion years.
Okay, so the conclusion is it had to have a start, right? You'd agree to that?
I don't agree to the notion of start or a beginning, because what went before that, I don't know.
You don't know, but the conclusion with the evidence that you do know would suggest that it started.
No, I'm not going to say probably it started.
You don't say the second law of thermodynamics is good evidence, Paul, for that?
The evidence suggested there was an explosion and that there's a rapid moving away from the center. You can see this through the spectroscopic analysis of the shift towards red as the astronomers look at the heavens. And so 15 to 20 billion years later, we're talking about a process of evolution which follows from that.
All right, I got a couple minutes here and we got to wrap this up. Norman, what would you postulate from the scientific evidence? And then Paul will let you respond, and Norman will come back to you here for a final word. But where are you going with the scientific evidence and what we're saying here?
It's very simple. I'm just using two principles. One is a fundamental rational principle that's the basis of all modern science. Every event, everything that comes to be, has a cause. The universe came to be, therefore the universe had a cause. And the evidence that the universe came to be is the second law of thermodynamics. It's running out of usable energy. Therefore, it can't be eternal or it would have run down a long time ago. Therefore, the universe must have had a beginning. That's a scientific fact. And if secular humanists want to be scientific, they have to face the facts. And the facts are that the universe had a beginning. If it had a beginning, there must have been a beginner. We can speculate later as to what kind of beginner, what kind of cause it was, but there had to be a cause. Otherwise, they're left with the absurd position that nothing produced something, and that is absurd.
Now, is that so irrational, Paul, what he just said?
Yes, I think it is. Mm-hmm. I think he, in the first place, he's introduced the notion that there had to be a beginner, you say. I deny that there was necessarily a beginning. But the notion that there
Why
had a beginner
deny-
is to read in some anthropomorphic or anthropocentric notion uh-huh. of someone who begins the universe, some person.
Okay, Paul, let me just get the question right. Is it, what would you call the fact of a full stop, and the evidence suggests that, what would you call it?
Well, as I said at the earlier point, I was a skeptic about the origins of the universe. That was my first point. I don't think we have sufficient evidence to say. And this is merely conjecture and merely guesswork, and it's not scientific. It's merely a theological hope.
Why do all the scientists, even skeptics, atheists and agnostics, believe that the universe had a beginning? And even Paul Davies is talking about the universe coming into existence out of nothing, without a cause. And Anthony Kinney and Robert Jastrow and all the scientists, they're not disputing that the universe had a beginning. All the evidence points it. They may dispute whether there's a God who caused it, but I think you're not looking at the evidence when you say the universe didn't have a beginning, because there's firm evidence that it did.
Physicists are uncertain at that point whether
okay.
there's sufficient
matter. We got a break. We're going to come back to this topic next week. We're going to move on to the second and third points of this thing, because in the manifestos you say the theory of evolution is nonetheless supported impressively by the findings of many scientists, sciences, and the evolution of the species is supported so strongly by the weight of evidence that it's difficult to reject it. Although we want to talk about the things that materialists have yet to explain adequately to some people anyway, Paul, namely, everything ultimately came from nothing, order came from chaos, harmony came from discord, life came from non-life, reason came from irrationality, personality came from non-personality, and morality came from amorality. Now, we need to have your comments on that, and we're going to ask Paul to give them to us in the next program, so please join us. Tonight we're talking about secular humanism, and my guests are Dr. Paul Kurtz, the man who drafted the Humanist Manifesto II and a secular humanist declaration. He's also the editor of the main secular humanist magazine in America called The Free Inquiry, and he's professor of philosophy at the State University of New York at Buffalo. And also Dr. Norman Geisler, an Orthodox Christian who is a professor at Dallas Theological Seminary, and the author of many books on philosophy and theology. We're picking it up, guys, where we left off last week, namely, is there evidence for the views that the secular humanists put out in terms of the manifestos? And in the manifesto, it says that the theory of evolution is supported impressively by the findings of many sciences. And the evolution of the species is supported so strongly by the weight of evidence that it is difficult to reject it. And Paul and Norman, I'd like to come tonight and zero in on the second phase of this. Last week we talked about the origin of the universe. This week I'd like to talk about the conflict between the Christian point of view and the secular humanist point of view concerning the origin of first life. After we have the universe here, we got another problem. The origin of first life, and then the origin of new life forms, including man. Okay? Paul, let me start with you. What impressive scientific evidence, according to the Humanist Manifesto, you've got all this, supports your secular humanistic view that first life came from non-life by accident, by chance? How did first life originate on Earth?
Well, you know, this is not simply a secular humanist viewpoint. The theory of evolution is so well supported by various sciences. In fact, I think it's one of the key principles of the whole of modern science. Let alone biology, genetics, paleontology, anthropology. Geology and astronomy presuppose it. We have the notion that the universe is changing and evolving over a long period of time, and we can see this everywhere. And this is confirmed by converging evidence from many sciences.
Okay, how did first life, according to scientific evidence, originate here on Earth? Give me the evidence that you...
Well, there are different theories about that. Organic matter probably exists in other parts of the universe, not only on this planet. One hypothesis is that certain conditions of hydrogen in the atmosphere many years ago, there was a primordial soup, and that it gradually organic matter evolved in the forms that it took on this planet. This is going back approximately 3 billion years.
Is that the hypothesis you want to work with?
That's a hypothesis that seems, in the light of present evidence, to best fit the facts.
How many hypotheses are out there, Paul?
Science has many hypotheses. The notion of science is that you have a hypothesis, you try to support it by the evidence. There may be new hypotheses introduced. You constantly revise it. The fact of evolution seems to be very well supported by the sciences today. How it happened precisely is constantly changing.
But how can you have a fact you don't know how it happened?
There are many things that we don't know how it happened.
But why call it
fact?
That's
no problem.
Are Christians wrong when we say that, you know, you sound awfully impressive in the manifestos? You know, it's like, you know, you guys got it wrapped up and we just need to check you out here. And you can let us in on the scoop of what the evidence really is. It is nonetheless supported impressively. Okay, I thought you had some impressive information there. And it's supported so strongly by the weight of evidence, it's difficult to reject it. Now you've got a bunch of hypotheses.
The evidence is that you find in the geological strata various fossils over a period of time. And you can see changes in species and the extinction of some species.
You're talking about transitional forms ought to be there. You're saying that Darwin postulated from smaller to more complex, and we're going to have all these transitional forms there, and the fossil record shows that conclusion. Is that correct?
The fossil record is not entirely complete, but what you find is...
How complete is it, Paul?
It is complete enough to support the hypothesis that there is evolution and change going on over a period of time. And you can see, for example, the extinction of some species that have disappeared, that no longer exist, and the emergence of new species. Now, evolution occurs in two ways. One is gradualism. The other is punctuated equilibria. In other words, there are sudden spurts in history at the same time.
Okay, let's come to Norman. We got those two on the board, Norman. First life, as well as the fact of the fossil record. And let me throw in here, Dr. Paul Lemoyne, a French scholar and editor of the French Encyclopedia, states, evolution is a fairy tale for adults. Why would he say that, Norman?
Well, I don't know, but I'm tempted to say because he just listened to what Paul Kurtz said. I was listening for this impressive evidence. I didn't hear a shred of evidence, let alone impressive evidence. I heard a couple of hypotheses suggested. Let me quote an evolution. Haldane, in his book, said that this theory of hot dilute soup has been in the textbooks for over 30 years without a shred of geological evidence that it ever existed. That's an evolutionist. I commend to your attention a recent book written by three scientists entitled The Mystery of Life's Origin, where they totally destroy the credibility of the spontaneous generation view. And even Fred Hoyle, whom he knows very well, a former atheist who started to figure out what would the chances be of life evolving on Earth by pure chance or coming from outer space, and he concluded that the chances for a single cell animal evolving on Earth would be 1 in 10 to the 40,000th power. That's more atoms than there are in the whole universe. So the former atheist Fred Hoyle concluded there must have been an intelligent creator of first life, and his colleague Wick Ramasinghe said believing that life came by chance is like believing that Boeing 747 resulted from a tornado going through a junkyard. You have to have a lot of faith to believe that.
Well, the Boeing 747 evolved. We can go back and see the Wright brothers, the first kind of airplane that they created in a period of time. There's an evolution. Yes, that they invented
in
a period of time. But there's a period of time
in which these forms
changed.
But then they create those airplanes via intelligence,
I was using the analogy that he was doing.
My argument.
Well, no, what are you denying?
Drop that one.
No,
find another one.
No, that's a meaningful. It seems to me the point I made is a good point, because there has been a change in airplanes from the simplest to the more
but
complex.
Always by intelligence.
But are you denying the existence, Norman Geisler? Are you denying the existence of evolution? Is this what you're saying?
I'm saying there is not a shred of evidence for macroevolution. Not only is there no impressive evidence, there's not a shred of evidence for macroevolution. How about that for a different view?
Well, then what do you do with paleontology, geology, anthropology, all the sciences which have found different forms of life through different periods of time, and you can reconstruct a kind of line of development?
But Paul, I'm sure that you're familiar with your buddies like Gould at Harvard and all these guys. I mean, why are they changing their theories? They don't buy that anymore.
The change of a theory is to the credit of science. Science is not absolute, it's not fixed, it's not final. It's an open method of investigation.
But they went away from what you're talking about, is what I'm saying.
Well, you have both processes happening at the same time. You have chance mutations which occur in certain species, and these are adaptable, and that then by means of natural selection and by differential reproduction, this mutation, because it is adaptable, is passed down to other members of the same species, and so there is a change in the species that
occurs.
Paul,
you're so lovable. I tell you, I put my arms right around you, but I tell you, I've got to say that.
Well, John Ankenberg, you're lovable too, but are you rejecting evolution?
In a big time way, because I'm reading
really?
Your buddies. Yes, you're right.
I see. Well, let's leave love aside and let's deal with the evidence.
Cognition. Okay. Let's deal with the evidence. Let me tell
let's
you,
go to the evidence.
Gould of Harvard, for example. One of the head paleontologists in America, I met him at the Arkansas trial. He says there is no evidence for the so-called missing links. All you have really are the leaves on the tree. The tree is drawn by the evolutionists. The tree doesn't exist out there in nature. The head paleontologist of British Museum, Dr. Colin Patterson, whom I talked to not too long ago, gave a speech here in November to the top scientists in America. He said not only is evolution no knowledge, it is anti-knowledge. And I've worked on this stuff 18 years and know nothing from it. And he concluded the missing links are not only missing, they never were there, and they will never be found. And he said, if I knew of any, I would have put them in my book because I'm an evolutionist, but he admits that they aren't there. Now, what the evidence shows is that new forms of life come into existence suddenly, in complete functional form, and disappear suddenly. That looks like creation to me, not evolution.
Yeah, some of those things are what? Walruses, sea lions, bats. You know, those are just a few that, from what I've read in the paleontology books, is all of a sudden, voila, they're there, and they go all the way back, and they're the same way all the way back.
Are you suggesting that God intervenes in history and creates these species and then destroys them? Is this your point?
No, my point is that God intervenes in history and creates them.
And destroys them, too?
No, he doesn't destroy them.
Well, who destroyed the dinosaur?
The dinosaurs were destroyed at the flood. Did you ever hear about the book of Genesis
when
Noah
how?
Took all these animals in the ark?
I heard about it, but I'm shocked that you believe in it, actually. But
well,
maybe I should know better.
No, you shouldn't be shocked to believe in it. The Bible
the dinosaurs were destroyed 10,000 years ago?
The dinosaurs, we didn't say that the universe was only 10,000. You
okay.
just said
when
that.
When did the flood occur?
I don't know when the flood
well,
occurred.
Well, I thought you were quoting the Bible.
The Bible doesn't say when the flood
okay.
occurred.
Can you give a suggestion of when it occurred?
I most certainly can give
yes,
a suggestion.
About how long ago?
It occurred in the book of Genesis, chapters 6, 7, and 8.
Okay.
And the record there is historical.
Well.
And for that matter, we know that because the Ebla tablets that have recently been discovered give us time periods back into the first 11 chapters of Genesis where these are historical events. They name city and places. This is not myth. This is history that's recorded in
early chapters.
Historical
myth, but or
not
mythological
a historical
history.
Myth
but,
either.
Okay, but did the flood occur 10 million years ago?
Doesn't matter when it occurred.
Well, can you give me some time scale?
The point is this, that God intervened in history. You asked me, did he intervene? Yes, we know because when things come into existence, they're fully formed. Yes, we know because they're fully functioning. The first bird had feathers and could fly. It didn't come with half feathers or scales on it. It was fully formed feathers and could fly.
Also, can I jump in here at the evolution creation trial? There was a guy that I think showed up from one of the laboratories and talked about polonium halos that has a bearing on the flood here. Maybe you could bring us up to date on what that was.
Yes, they never answered that. Dr. Robert Gentry talked about polonium halos, which are half-life halos, and they exist in bedrock, granite, and coal all over the world. They're daughter halos, and all of the basic granite would have had to come into existence in less than 3.5 minutes because they're 3.5 minute half-life. No one has ever even attempted to refute that.
You know, there are species that have been
extinct.
Can you
refute that?
I've not investigated that question, so I will reserve judgment about it. But I'm surprised that you say that the dinosaur was not extinct 20, 30 million years ago, but more recently, where all the scientific evidence suggests that there was a meteor shower, as one hypothesis, and that there was insufficient food on the planet, and this was the reason for the extinction of the dinosaurs.
All the scientific
to do with the
evidence
flood.
Suggests is one hypothesis. Those you contradict yourself in one sentence there. If all the scientific evidence suggests it, it's not one hypothesis.
Well, but to claim that the dinosaurs were killed by a flood is completely unsupportable by any evidence at all.
To claim they were killed by a meteor shower all over the world and everything else didn't die too is also completely unsupportable.
It's not completely unsupportable because at least you have a range of testable evidence in the sciences where you're drawing simply upon the Bible, which is based upon faith. Now, if you maintain
the Bible is not based on faith, it's based on fact.
If you maintain there was a Noachian flood, and if the flood had to be as high as Mount Ararat, then it is estimated there would have had to have been 3 miles of water to cover the earth.
You're assuming that the water had to be as deep all over the world, number one. You're assuming that Mount Ararat is the same height number two, and you're assuming that there isn't that water available number three. All those are assumptions.
Well,
prove them.
But according to the Bible, if the whole earth was covered by water, then you would have to cover the highest mountain peak, and you would have to have an awful lot of water to do so.
Even the water in this glass peaks. You can have water 2 miles deep here, and just a little over there could be 1 mile deep, and it could still cover the whole earth. All it says is it covered Mount Ararat by that height. It didn't say that everywhere in the world, every mountain that now exists at its present height was covered by that distance. You're adding to the Bible in order to refute the Bible. That's a straw man.
In order to kill all of life on the planet, you would have to cover all portions of the planet. You maintain that the flood was not universal and did not cover the whole planet.
No, I maintain the flood was universal.
And covered the whole planet.
And killed everybody except eight people. And all of the animals that Noah brought in the ark were saved.
All of the million species that he brought into the
not
ark.
Not a million species that he brought
into the
ark.
There are a million species today.
Yes, but species is an artificial category that scientists created. It's not a natural category. The kinds of Genesis are not to be equated with the species.
Well, you have wide diversity of species on the earth at the present, and presumably they were saved in the ark. The ark would have to be awful large in order to contain all the species.
It's been proven that the ark is large enough to contain all the thousands of kinds of animals that there are.
That is highly questionable. Not only contain the animals, but the food. Who would clean the manure, for example, in Noah's Ark?
It's not highly questionable. It is mathematically provable. All you have to do is get your calculator out, figure the thousands of animals there were, figure the size of the ark, and there's plenty of room for all of them. Noah had a ventilating system in the ark. It even indicates it there in Genesis. And the manure was good fertilizer after he got out.
All right, let me.
But he had trouble walking through it.
Norman, I want to move on to another question, but we do want to talk about what do you have to say concerning first life here? What's the scientific evidence as far as you're concerned concerning first life?
The scientific evidence of first life is very strong. Dr. Yaki, in the Journal of Theoretical Biology, 1981, wrote an article where he showed that the new information theory discovered by Bell Laboratories proves that there's a mathematical identity between the specified complexity you find in the DNA and the kind of information you find, let's say, in a dictionary or an encyclopedia. Now, the first living thing, a single-cell animal, has enough information that, if spelled out in English, would fill one volume of an encyclopedia. And to believe that that happened by an explosion in a printing shop, say, is irrational. To believe that an intelligent being can put that together is rational. Now, what I would like to suggest is there are two alternatives. Either non-intelligent force put all that specified complexity together, or an intelligent being. I'd like to see a shred of evidence in the present from Dr. Kurtz, a shred of evidence to show that regularly, repeatedly, and science is built on regularity and repeatability, that non-intelligent forces can produce specified complexity as great as a dictionary.
Well, encyclopedia is created by human beings, so that the analogy doesn't follow. You have various forms of being in the universe with various degrees of complexity. I don't see where you have to invoke some mystical, hidden, occult, intelligent being in order to explain
it's not
it.
Mystical,
I take
hidden,
nature
or
as
occult.
I find, take nature as you find it with all of the complexities. And you describe it and
I
account
am taking
for it
nature
as best
I find
as you can,
it, and then
without
I'm asking
reading in something beyond the evidence.
Questions: what caused this? That's
well, I don't have. Look, I said earlier I was a skeptic. I don't know the causes of everything. If I don't know,
do you know the
causes,
cause of anything?
Yes, if I don't know the cause of something, I will suspend judgment. A cause is an effort at a regularity. A cause is an effort at an explanation.
If you saw Mount Rushmore, would you assume, even if you had never seen, that it had an intelligent cause?
Because I know people have used a chisel in order to chisel faces.
But just looking at Mount Rushmore and seeing those faces, you would assume an intelligent cause of that.
Of course.
Okay.
Because I've seen the intelligent being created.
There is more specified complexity and intelligent information in the first DNA than there is on Mount Rushmore. Why won't you assume an intelligent cause of that?
Because here's an analogy that you're reading into nature, because I can see the sculptor create Mount Rushmore, but I have not seen any sculptor.
But you didn't
in
see
part.
The sculptor create Mount Rushmore. All you see is Mount Rushmore, and you assume an intelligent cause.
Because as a matter of fact, I did see it, so that's a bad analogy, and you did too. But we know about human culture. We know human beings create statues. All right, so this is something we observe. But you're going far beyond the observation.
That's the whole point.
Not taking nature as you find it with
Exactly as I find it, and I'm observing that whenever you have specified complexity, complex information, it always had an intelligent cause.
No, that doesn't necessarily follow. Follow about nature.
Well, let me finish. Do you know of any cases where you have a regular production of complex information, such as a Mount Rushmore or DNA, where a non-intelligent force produces
it? Yes, throughout nature, constantly.
Never.
Yes,
never.
In physics and biology and anthropology and all the data that
we already
find,
specified.
You have complexity, you have regularity, you have nature taking on order.
But
you don't have to read in a
designer. Already there. And
it's
we trace
part of
it
nature.
Back to the beginning. How did the first...
You don't have to trace it back to the beginning.
But see, that's just reduplicating.
It's what you
that's
find.
Just a Xerox machine
you
reduplicating.
You formulate causal hypotheses and you explain these. You make predictions.
All you're saying is that, look, I have this page, and this page shows intelligent information, and I make a Xerox copy of it, a Xerox copy, and so that proves that there was no intelligence to produce the first page.
The page was produced by human beings. There's no problem here.
By an intelligent being, right?
By human beings, okay. But you have degrees of complexity in other parts of nature, and there's no evidence that they were produced by human beings or by God. You're reading
every time you get specified complexity, there's always an intelligent being. David Hume said that constant conjunction is the basis for rational conclusions. You see cause and effect connected over and over, and you assume a connection. If over and over and over again, every time you blow a fan on alphabet soup, you get a mess. If every time you drop a bomb in a printing shop, you get a mess. But then you see a dictionary, or you see spelled out with alphabet soup on the table, I love you, sign Mary. What do you always assume rationally? An intelligent cause.
I don't assume that. You do.
You don't
assume? I find regularities.
You don't assume that?
Yes, I find regularities.
If you came to your breakfast table and said, I love you, Paul Kurtz, signed, your wife, you wouldn't assume an intelligent being did that?
Yes, in the human context.
Oh,
in the human context. But you're going beyond that.
Of course
I find regularities in nature, and one doesn't necessarily mean that there's an architect.
We got to move on here. All right, we're into the discussion, and next we're going to take this discussion into the public schools, so please join us. Welcome. We're talking about secular humanism, and my guest tonight is Dr. Paul Kurtz, the man who drafted the Humanist Manifesto II, and also a secular humanist declaration. He's also the editor of the main secular humanist magazine in America entitled Free Inquiry, and he's also professor of philosophy at the State University of New York at Buffalo. My second guest is Dr. Norman Geisler, Christian, Orthodox Christian, who's a professor at Dallas Theological Seminary and the author of many books on philosophy and theology. Now, we've been talking about secular humanism, and is there any rational justification for being a humanist? We've been talking about the evidence for the origin of the universe and for the beginning of first life, as well as the development of life, and so on. And obviously, secular humanists support evolution. It's right in the manifestos. And Paul, I'd like to come to part of the manifesto concerning education. You say in the Secular Humanist Declaration that the first principle of democratic secular humanism is its commitment to free inquiry. We all clap on that one. You say, we oppose any tyranny over the mind of man. Okay? That's arbitrary power. And free inquiry requires that we tolerate diversity of opinion. We all like that. And then we respect the rights of individuals to express their beliefs, however unpopular they may be, without social or legal prohibition. And then I find a little inconsistency, Paul, here in the Declaration, because a few pages over, after you said those beautiful words...
Yes, they were beautiful, weren't they?
But despite this statement, you say... This is the same declaration, a couple pages over. You reject the teaching of scientific facts that support creationism by this statement. We deplore the efforts of fundamentalists, especially in the United States, to invade the science classrooms, requiring that creationist theory be taught to students and requiring that it be included in biology textbooks. This is a serious threat both to academic freedom and to the integrity of the educational process. Now, haven't you violated your own humanist principles where you just talk so beautifully about an open, free diversity of opinion, we can't put laws on people, and all of a sudden you turn around a couple pages later and you say, but we don't want any of those fundamentalists bringing up some of those facts that Geisler was talking about last week?
No, I don't find a contradiction on that point, John. I think that the integrity of science, the freedom of scientific research is vital. This country is based upon science. I think that I have no objection to creationist theories being taught in history of ideas courses or history courses or sociology courses in schools. But to impose them by political or legislative means on science teachers in the science classrooms and to insist that this biblical theory be taught side by side with a scientific theory, it seems to violate the most basic principle of science. And there has been this battle between religion and science going back to Galileo, in which there have been great martyrs in the history of scientific thought. If science itself, if biologists themselves believe that the creationist theories were useful, then by all means they should be taught.
But how would a guy like Wickramasinghe, that's a Buddhist, you know, slide his theories in sideways if you can't say anything about the fact it may lead to creation?
Well, Wickramasinghe is an astronomer, is he not? And he argues that, and it's an interesting hypothesis,
what I want to know is,
organic
being
may come from meteors from outer space on the planet Earth, yes.
Would you let him argue it, is what I'm saying? You're saying no.
Well, I'm saying, well, I think the point is that there's been demand for equal time, and that sounds fine.
I think it is fine, isn't
okay,
it?
Okay. Now, astrology, you take astrology, there are more astrologers in the United States than astronomers. I think something like 29% of the people in the United States believe in astrology. Now,
in
should
France,
astrology
it's even
worse. Be taught in astronomy, compelled to be taught in astronomy courses? It seems to me the answer is no.
But the fact is that
you undermine
astrologists...
the whole basis of astronomy. And I think that our children need the best education that they can get, and you're undermining the basis of biology and genetics by insisting by political power that this be taught in biology courses.
Before I answer that, I'm not the guest here. Geisler, why don't you get in here and say something about that?
Well, Paul, bless his heart, just blew a lot of smoke in your face. What he said wasn't true. It was all straw men. First of all, we're not requiring the biblical view. It explicitly states in the Arkansas law that no biblical view can be taught. We're requiring science be taught, scientific evidence for origins. Secondly, it was not equal time. That's already been ruled out by law. It was balanced treatment, not equal time. Equal time would be practically impossible. And thirdly, we're not trying to impose our views on him. It's the evolutionists that are trying to impose their view. In 1925, at the first Scopes trial, Clarence Darrow, the ACLU criminal lawyer who defended the evolutionist view, said, quote, "It is bigotry for public schools to teach only one theory of origin." In 1981 at Arkansas, and I was a witness there, the same ACLU argued it's bigotry for public schools to teach two theories of origin. Now, I came to a conclusion. Bigotry hasn't changed, just the bigots have.
Well, but you're assuming that the creationist theory is a scientific theory, whereas biologists deny that. That's a biblical theory. You appeal to the Bible. When an issue comes up about when were dinosaurs extinct, you say the Noachian flood supports that. So you're really using the Bible, and you're saying that this is scientific. This is merely a mask. Creationism is merely a mask for a religious doctrine. And what you have is a very basic notion of scientific freedom at stake in this country.
But Paul, you and I both have PhDs in philosophy. We both taught philosophy. I've taught logic. You've taught logic. What you just said was a classic case of special pleading. You said biologists don't consider it science. Evolutionary biologists don't consider it science, but creationist biologists do. You just engage in special pleading.
Not at all. In fact, you're an expert at special pleading, and perhaps I was taking an example from you.
Give me an
because,
example.
Because, I mean, if it were the case that the scientific biology journals thought that creationism was a useful hypothesis in explaining the fossils that we find on the planet Earth, that would be another matter. But the biologists throughout the country, throughout the world, reject this notion.
Evolutionary biologists throughout the country reject it. creationist biologists throughout
there
the country
very few,
don't.
There are very few creationist biologists. There are mainline biologists.
Of them.
There are very few. There are tens and tens of thousands of biologists.
Oh, so we decide truth by majority vote.
You have certain standards of scientific investigation. And if anyone with any point of view wants to impose it upon a science, this is a laughing stock
of scientific inquiry. That a minority point of view cannot be taught, because I hold the majority point of view is sheer bigotry.
That's
humanists,
too.
In my opinion, are bigots because they want only their view to be taught in the public schools. And I think the fundamentalists in 1925 were bigots because they wanted only their view. But I think you humanists in 1985 are equally bigots because you want only your view taught.
On the contrary, I don't think it involves bigotry at all. I think what it involves is the very basis of the scientific method or scientific inquiry.
Okay.
Because any dissident, you say that any dissident minority in any field can determine by using political power and the power of the state that certain textbooks should be used, even if the people who teach those courses are opposed to that.
Political power is in the hands of the evolutionists.
All right, let me jump in here, guys.
We ought to protect minority rights so that political power can't squelch
them. Let me jump in here, okay, and keep us going. Secular humanists speak of a right to education. Again, going back to the Humanist Declaration, you state, we believe that moral development should be cultivated in children and young adults. Hence, it is the duty of public education to deal with these values. Question is when you have people like John Dumphy, who says, I am convinced, and he's a secular humanist, that the battle for humankind's future must be waged and won in the public school classrooms by teachers who correctly perceive their role as the proselytizers of a new faith, a religion of humanity. The classroom must and will become an arena of conflict between the old and the new, the rotting corpse of Christianity, together with all its adjacent evils and misery, and the new faith of humanism. It seems to me that some of the secular humanists are looking as the school classroom, the public school classroom, where we have millions of Christian parents who pay their taxes to support the schools and what is taught. They're looking at it like they're going to convert those kids to a belief that the parents don't want them to be converted to.
You know, I think that is a libel against public school teachers. The quotation you read from John Dumphy was a student who entered a contest and they published an essay in the Humanist magazine. He does not speak for a humanist, nor does he speak for educators in the country, and I disagree with him.
Okay, let me give you one that does.
On the other hand, I think moral education ought to be taught in the schools. I think it is being taught in the schools, and you can't have education without it. I think we want the best education for us, our students. I don't think that the educational process should be either pro or anti-religious, either way.
Okay, but isn't bigotry defined as one who obstinately or intolerantly is devoted to his own beliefs or opinions? And the Humanist Manifesto seems to be strictly against this. For example, you say, the preciousness and dignity of the individual person is a central humanist value. We reject all religious, ideological, or moral codes that denigrate the individual, suppress freedom. We believe in the cultivation of feeling and love. And to enhance freedom and dignity, the individual must experience a full range of civil liberties, including freedom of speech, the legal right of opposition to government policies, and religious liberty. We are committed to an open and democratic society. All persons should have a voice in developing the values and goals that determine their lives. Let me finish this up. One of the
okay.
men, one of the men that signed that statement was Paul Blanchard. You got it listed in the back of the book.
Yes.
Blanchard says, though, we have an obligation to expose and attack the world of religious miracles, magic, Bible worship, salvationism, heaven, hell, and all mythical deities. We should be particularly specific and energetic in attacking such quack millennialists as Billy Graham and such embattled reactionaries as the Pope, because they represent the two greatest anti-humanist aggregates in our society. So it seems like we've got a bigot in the group here who says one thing in the manifesto and something else in society.
Paul Blanchard was a congregational minister. He endorsed the Humanist Manifesto too, as did hundreds and indeed thousands of people. And surely I'm not going to defend everything that Paul Blanchard said, but he's not talking about the classroom on that point, is he?
He's talking about society as a whole.
He's talking about society as a whole. Oh, okay, about that, it seems to me that if Christians and Orthodox people have a right to their point of view, then skeptics and non-believers have a right to their point of view in a free market of ideas. We're not talking about the schools now. In a free market of ideas,
why not the schools,
pro then? And anti-religious isn't points of view ought to
we
contend.
Always assumed that the schools were part of the free market.
Granted, but the schools, but concerning the First Amendment to the Constitution, Congress shall make no law respecting the establishment of religion or the free exercise thereof. The schools are supposed to be neutral in regard to religion, pro or anti-religion.
But if secular humanism is a religion defined by the Supreme Court, then you're teaching your religion.
Do you accept everything the Supreme Court defines? Or
certainly
does?
Don't, but they sure got
do you
now.
Do you accept them on abortion, John?
No, I don't, but do you...
You don't. Okay, so don't quote the Supreme Court. I don't accept the Supreme Court on that point either. I don't think secular humanism is a religion.
I won't quote them. I'll quote the Humanist Manifesto 1. Okay? Humanist Manifesto 1 says that it is a religion. You and your own magazine, you have your own boys, 67,000 of the Unitarians say that it is a religion.
Well, the humanism is not a dogma. There are wide differences among there are as many
so
humanist positions as
Paul
there are
Tillich's
humanists.
Theological definition of a person that believes mean ultimate commitment. You don't have an ultimate commitment to secular humanists?
There are religious humanists. I'm a secular humanist myself.
But isn't that your ultimate commitment,
Paul? I don't
Paul?
Think that humanism is a religion. I think it's a scientific, a philosophical, and an ethical position.
Now, the question is, should we let you teach your religion, or do we get a chance to at least get our views on the board, too?
I don't think that religion should be taught in the public schools. And I think the fact that one teaches modern literature, modern science, exposes children to a wide range of ideas is not teaching religion.
Dr. Geisler, what do you think?
Well, some humanists call themselves religious and some don't. But that doesn't take away from the fact that legally they're recognized as a religion and can get conscientious draft status from it as the American Humanist Association did. Humanist Manifesto calls itself religion. Humanist Manifesto 2 implies also that it's a religion. The Supreme Court recognized it was a religion. It's recognized by definition. I did my doctoral dissertation on this very topic. What is religion? It's a commitment to something. John Dewey, who signed that has enduring value. John Dewey, who signed the Humanist Manifesto 1, thought it was a religion. He wrote a book called The Common Faith. They're just simply copying out when they say it's not a religion, because it is a religion. It's recognized as a religion, and the premises of secular humanism can be taught in the public schools. But the premises of Christianity can't be. Now, I think we ought to be fair. If we're going to be pluralistic and open, we ought to be able to teach the premises of both.
I don't think that secular humanism as a religion is being taught in the schools. I think that is a libel against our millions of school teachers. I think what is being taught is modern literature, modern science, modern philosophy, the whole range of knowledge.
Well,
and our students should learn that.
Okay, let me back up and quote you. Okay, good source. Secular Humanism, a Religion, an article that you had in the Free Inquiry. You quote Paul Tillich, and you say, he introduced the term ultimate concern to refer to this form of religiosity. And here he was referring to the human qualities of experiences and claimed that as religious Christians, Jews and Muslims, may be devoted to their religious faith or creed, so atheists, Marxists, and naturalists may have an equal devotion and dedication to theirs. This commitment may be called religious if it expresses one's whole response to life, to core attitudes and values. That's Paul Kurtz.
But you're quoting me out of context, John.
I read it, right?
I then went on to say, however, if one used religious in that way, then a vegetarian is religious. Anyone
no.
who's dedicated to
you
any
You didn't have
field,
anybody speak back to you on that point.
Anyone who's dedicated to any field, then you can't teach anything in the schools. I mean, if you're devoted to literature with commitment, then it's religious. But that seems to me to be nonsense.
But the thing can I take
theologian.
Up on your logic at that point?
Yes.
If you're talking about a vegetarian, he can feel strongly about it and not be his ultimate commitment.
It could be his ultimate. You know vegetarians like I know vegetarians?
Yeah, it could be
his ultimate
commitment.
If it is,
then it would apply, wouldn't it?
Well, then nothing. You see, anything that anyone feels strongly about as a religion, then nothing can be taught
point,
in the
John.
Schools.
Let me check on this point. I agree with Paul here. Let me tell you why. Because it's the same kind of illogic that they use on teaching creation. They say creation is believed by religious people, therefore creation shouldn't be taught in the public schools. Doesn't follow, does it? Just because a humanist believes in vegetarianism or a humanist believes in something else doesn't mean if you're teaching those, you're automatically teaching religion. Likewise, if you're teaching creationism, you're not automatically teaching religion either, and yet you called it a religion early on by the same kind of logic that you just tried to refute John with.
Well, I think your point on this point, let me meet you halfway on this. It's true.
You going to back off?
No, I'm not going to back off. I'm going to move ahead. But
how do you
from
do
your
it by,
point,
how do you go halfway
well,
without gonna, backing
what
off?
What I'm going to say is that humanists believe in evolution, but so do other people, Christians and Jews. Most liberal Christians and Jews and others believe in evolution in our country too. It's only a narrow fundamentalist or literalist interpretation or evangelical interpretation that does not. But if you go through the whole gamut of what's taught in the schools, most people believe in science today. The fact that the humanists believe in science doesn't make science humanist, or doesn't mean that everyone who teaches it is a humanist. But now, in regard to creationism, if I were convinced that creationism was a meaningful hypothesis in science today, then I would say, yes, it ought to be examined. Incidentally, I do teach creationism in my classes in philosophy where it is appropriate, but it's not appropriate to force it on the biologists.
But let me tell you why it is. Number one, M.B. Foster in 1934 in Mind, a prestigious English philosophy journal started by G. E. Moore that you're familiar with, said that the origin of modern science is the doctrine of creation. Whitehead said that the concept of a creator was the origin of modern science. Yaki says it. Gilkey said every major historian of the philosophy of science agrees that the history of modern science would not have arisen without the doctrine of a creator and creation. Secondly, from 1620 to 1860, every one of the major scientists, with few exceptions, believed in a creator and creation. Now, you're telling me that what was the origin of modern science and that what scientists believed for 240 years, what thousands of scientists still believe today, isn't science. You're like the black ant on the anthill looking at the brown ant and saying, you're not an ant and that's not an anthill.
On the contrary, Norman, science began when the scientist rejected authority, when he rejected appeals to mere revelation, when he said that belief should be based upon evidence in the laboratory. Science can only begin when you move beyond faith. So it was when scientists moved beyond their purely religious commitment that the door was open to inquiry. Now, it's true that many scientists are believers, and many scientists are not believers. And it's true that historically, many scientists did believe in creation.
Okay,
but we're going beyond that. We're talking about the 20th century, in which that's not a meaningful hypothesis in the life sciences.
You know, but I certainly liked the words that you had in the manifesto. I think you ought to just add a few of these paragraphs that you want freedom to teach your thought. You know, you don't want freedom for all thoughts. You want freedom to teach your thought. Let me give you a quote from Dr. Pierce at Harvard, who addressed 2,000 teachers in Denver and said this: every child in America who enters school at the age of 5 is mentally ill because he comes to school with allegiance toward our elected officials, toward our founding fathers, toward our institutions, toward the preservation of this form of government, patriotism, nationalism, sovereignty. All of that proves that children are sick, because the truly well individual is one who has rejected all of those things and is what I would call the true international child of the future. Do you agree with that?
No, I don't agree with that.
I'm glad to hear that.
Surely you quote people. Do I agree with that? I don't know that I don't know that. I've never heard of that man. I don't know that he's a humanist. I don't agree with that at
it
all.
It seems like that it's in line with the humanist
freedom,
manifesto.
And I do believe in freedom, and I believe in the open market of ideas, and I believe in the clash of ideas.
Except
but
for
also
creation.
But also I don't want to impose, because of the long battle, I do not want to oppose upon free scientific investigation.
Well, we're
I think
imposing
that's
evolution
what's
on people. Two-thirds of Americans believe in creation. The early scientists believed it was the basis for modern science. But I say, and my buddies say, it's not science, therefore you can't teach it. That's bigotry. Let's face it, Paul.
It's not bigotry, Norman. You're interpreting it as bigotry.
Okay, I need a 30-second statement from both of you here. Paul, go ahead.
Well, I think that what is at issue is freedom of scientific research, the best education for our children, the effort to oppose any effort, the need to oppose any effort from outside the classroom or outside science to impose a doctrinaire dogma upon it.
Norman?
I agree with that 100%, except that he's inconsistent in that he's saying freedom of ideas as long as they're humanist ideas, freedom of ideas as long as they're evolutionist ideas, but if there's anything that opposes my humanism or evolution, sorry, you're not free.
Okay, we're going to talk about what's happening with the court. Are the secular humanists, are they legislating morality on the rest of us? So please join us. We're talking tonight about secular humanism. Is there any rational justification for being a humanist? And is it more or less rational for a person to hold a biblical Christian beliefs? My guests are Dr. Paul Kurtz, the man who drafted the Humanist Manifesto II, and a secular humanist declaration. He's also the editor of the main secular humanist magazine in America entitled Free Inquiry. He's also professor of philosophy at the State University of New York at Buffalo. And also, my second guest, Dr. Norman Geisler, an Orthodox Christian scholar, professor at Dallas Theological Seminary, the author of many books on philosophy and theology. Tonight we want to talk about secular humanists' view of God. And in the Humanist Declaration, Paul, we find these statements that you say, secular humanists, we find that traditional views of the existence of God either are meaningless have not yet been demonstrated to be true. Secular humanists find insufficient evidence for the claim that some divine purpose exists for the universe. They reject the idea that God has intervened miraculously in history or revealed himself to a chosen few, or that he can save or redeem sinners. We reject the divinity of Jesus. We do not accept as true the literal interpretation of the Old and New Testaments. Now, along with this, in the magazine that you're the editor of, Free Inquiry, I believe this was the last one out, wasn't it? I was really appalled here, Paul, that you have a deal, was Jesus a God? And the statement that's made in here, Jesus nowhere claims to be a God in the New Testament. Paul, you really want to go with that?
Who is that article by, John?
Tom Franzik.
I see. Yes. Well, the question, you're raising the question, is Jesus the Son of God? Is he divine? What's the evidence for that?
Yeah. First of all, though, I looked at this article and I just had to say that most Christians that have opened their Bible and looked at it would say, this guy couldn't find any verses. He says, nowhere did Jesus claim to be a God.
Yes.
I never checked out Mark 2, never checked out the book of John, where even the enemies of Jesus said, he being a man makes himself out to be a God. Or Jesus said,
I don't necessarily agree with Tom Franzik in that article. Being the editor of a journal, I don't agree with everything that I publish in the journal.
Okay, glad to hear that.
But in any case, I don't think there's sufficient evidence to say that Jesus was divine. Take it to that point, because I don't take the Bible as divinely inspired. I think the Bible is a human document, like the Koran, like the Book of Mormon, and that these were written by primitive people, the Bible over 1,000 years on the eastern shore of the Mediterranean, and I don't think that the claims of revelation or miracles, as you read in the Bible, can be supported by the evidence. That's why I'm a skeptic about the divinity of Jesus.
Okay, you don't think there's enough evidence concerning the life, death, and resurrection of Jesus Christ supported by the historical documents of the New Testament to give probability historically that Jesus is God?
The answer to that is no. Now, I'm not a biblical scholar. That's not my field, biblical criticism, so I will speak as a philosopher. I find that the New Testament, the four Gospels of the New Testament, as far as I can tell, were not written by eyewitnesses. They were written by people who themselves did not know Jesus directly, neither Paul nor Mark or the other authors of the Gospel.
Then you're not familiar with William F. Albright, Johns Hopkins, who said before he died that every one of the books of the New Testament was written by a baptized Jew between the time of 40 to 80 A.D., probably somewhere between 50 to 75?
Yes, granted, after the death of Jesus. Yes, but did not know him directly. They were written.
Well, they would all still be alive. They'd have been contemporaries of Jesus
If Jesus had died, we're not certain, somewhere about 30 A.D., then the books of the New Testament were written from 20 to 30 to 50 years after his death.
Okay, you don't know of any evidence there. Dr. Geisler, you've written about 20 books on that topic, so give us a little evidence in terms of from history and any way you want to go on that one.
Well, very simple. Let's start at the top. Jesus did claim to be God. He said, I and the Father are one. They took up stones to stone him. He said, he forgives sins. They said, who can forgive sins but God only? He said, before Abraham was, I am. There's no anybody who looks seriously at the New Testament knows that Jesus claimed to be God. Then he offered three proofs. He fulfilled prophecy, made hundreds of years in advance. He lived a sinless, miraculous life. He predicted and accomplished his resurrection from the dead. No one in history has made those claims and offered that evidence and pulled it off. There are more historical documents that verify the New Testament as being authentic. There are 5,366 Greek manuscripts alone that verify the New Testament, say nothing of 15,000 other copies, to go right back to the threshold of the first century. It was written by eyewitness contemporaries of the events. His resurrection was witnessed by over 500 people. Paul said most of whom are still alive. There's more evidence that Jesus lived, claimed to be God, and proved it than there is that Caesar crossed the Rubicon. So if the skeptic wants to be skeptical, and wipe out the New Testament. He has to wipe out ancient history, too, for which there's less evidence.
Well, I didn't realize we were going to argue the Bible, because I'm not a biblical scholar. So
this is part of the Humanist Manifesto,
I have to bring what I've read on this.
Mine.
As best I've read the Bible many, many times, but I'm not a minister of the cloth. But let me speak as a skeptic and as a non-believer. As far as I can tell, there's no independent confirmation from sources outside the Gospels written at that time.
Careful, Paul.
The Gospels were written by propagandists for the faith, people
Paul,
who believed,
you don't really say
who believed
that,
in Christianity, and were not, and they were not.
Paul,
they
you're,
were not
you're proving that you're not a scholar in this area, Paul, because there's just too much evidence. Let me go this way. I gotta nail you down here. You have a quote in one of your books that you say we have got to base our conclusions on evidence. And you say we will follow those conclusions right to the end, no matter where they lead us. Now, here's my little question before I ask Geisler to give us a little evidence. If we show you the evidence, will you change your mind?
I would, but I've looked at the evidence. I've read everything I can about it, and I still, and the more I read, I have been reading the Bible. I wish I'd read the Bible more intensively when I was younger. I'd be a stronger atheist than I am now.
Let's answer your question then concerning what you said there, concerning the sources as well as.
Are there sources outside the gospel?
Okay, Dr. Geisler, what about that? You've written one big whole 500-page book on that topic. Give us a few shreds of evidence there.
611 pages.
Sorry about that.
Sorry. Well, first of all, look what he's saying. He's saying, take a courtroom scene and pretend he's one of the attorneys, and he's saying, now look, Geisler, apart from your eyewitnesses, you have a pretty poor case, don't you? I mean, of course, the eyewitnesses are in the New Testament.
Who are the eyewitnesses? None of them were contemporaneous. Mark didn't know Jesus, nor did Luke, Matthew, or John.
Matthew was a disciple. He spent 3.5 years with Jesus. I imagine he knew him quite well. Mark was probably the young man in the gospel of Mark the End. He was a secretary and assistant of Peter, who was an apostle. He was a contemporary of Christ. Luke looked into he was a contemporary and looked into the sources. He was a doctor, a historian that Ramsey showed that was accurate in everything he could check on, and was a skeptic before he checked out Luke. John was an eyewitness. The Apostle Paul was an eyewitness. All of them were eyewitnesses.
How is Apostle Paul an eyewitness? Did he know Jesus?
Yes, he certainly did. He knew Jesus, and he was a witness of the resurrection, and he lists himself in 1 Corinthians 15 as one of the witnesses of the resurrection because Christ appeared to him. In fact, Christ
appeared him on the road to Damascus, but he said, this was an uncorroborated observation, but he did not know Jesus at the time that Jesus was alive, as far as I can tell.
He most certainly did, because if he appeared to him on the road to Damascus, that was only a short time after
the death of Jesus.
But they also preached.
There is a body of biblical criticism which denies that Matthew was an apostle of Jesus, right, and denies that any of the other three writers of the Gospels knew Jesus. Now, you're differing with that interpretation.
Well, Paul,
at least it's an arguable question. There are people who maintain that the authors were of the second generation and were not contemporaneous with Jesus.
Well, put it this way. There were people who believed that. That's a pre-archaeological point of view. But most scholars, even rabid scholars like Robinson, the Death of God scholar, J. Robinson, who wrote a book redating the New Testament, in which he says all the basic Gospels were written between 45 and 65 during the life of the eyewitness, and he didn't even believe in the existence of God, so he didn't have any axe to grind. That was a view, but it's archaeological curiosity now rather than really a serious scholarly view.
Okay, then
I deny that point. There are serious scholars who dissent with your interpretation.
But there's also a lot of what he's saying, archaeological data. Plus, when we were talking about in the documents themselves, if you remember, if you've read the book of Acts, where Paul himself on trial before Agrippa points to Agrippa and says, you know the things that I'm talking about, because these things weren't hidden, they weren't done in a corner. Even he was preaching to other people that were eyewitnesses.
He mentions 500 people having seen the resurrection of Christ. We have no statement of the 500 people. I mean, this is uncorroborated testimony given by people who are creating a new religion. It would not hold up in a court of law. Most of the Gospels are contradictory on many points. As I read the Gospels side by side, I find that they contradict each other on very important points.
Let's take them one at a time. Uncorroborated testimony. You have Matthew, Mark, Luke, John, Paul, Peter, James, that's hardly uncorroborated. You got in the mouth of two or three witnesses, every word shall be established. So you've got corroborated testimony. Secondly, they were eyewitness testimony. Thirdly, there aren't any contradictions. There are alleged contradictions in the gospel. And the alleged contradictions actually argue for the authenticity of the witnesses because they called it as they saw it. They didn't get together and try and put this thing together. And you get that type of thing when you get independent testimonies.
Well, if you read the resurrection, as I read the four parts side by side, in one case you have, let's see if I can reconstruct. You have a youth dressed in white. You have two angels, first inside the tomb and then outside the tomb. You have different reports. I suggest that anyone who wants to have an open mind about this, read the four Gospels side by side, and the eyewitnesses differ on that point.
Well, I have read the four Gospels, and I read that point, and there's nothing contradictory that either you pointed out or that can be pointed out in that record. Sure, you had two angels, and sure, they were in the tomb once, and sure, they were outside, but that's not a contradiction.
Well, but you have if you have an accident, or if you have a crime, and you have witnesses, and if your witnesses give different testimony, what are you to make about this?
You're to assume that if their testimony differs,
testimony does differ.
It's independent testimony, and that's the kind of thing that actually argues for the authenticity of it. And to bring out the other point you made, that it wouldn't stand up in a court of law. As a matter of fact, a professor of Harvard University of Law a number of years ago, Simon Greenleaf, was challenged on that very point. Now, he wrote the book on legal evidence used by lawyers to test these things in court. And they challenged him to apply that same logic to the New Testament and see what he'd conclude. Here's what he concluded. New Testament documents are authentic. The witnesses are reliable. Jesus Christ really rose from the dead. You ought to read it. The testimony of the evangelist, Simon Greenleaf.
Well, let me jump to the next topic because we only got a few minutes.
Part.
Right. What do you think about the resurrection of Jesus Christ from the dead?
Well, how many witnesses were there for that? Why did not Jesus appear to non-Christians?
How about Thomas? Was he a Christian? He says, I won't
believe.
Well,
he was a doubter, but he was one of the disciples.
Well, he's like you then,
wasn't
he?
Well, but why didn't Jesus appear in Rome, or why didn't he come before Pontius Pilate?
Well, you asked me, and I just gave you an example, and he did.
Because he only appears to the people who believe in him. This is an article of faith.
Again, did Thomas believe in him? He says, I won't believe unless I check out the empirical data.
This is written after the fact. What the facts are, we don't know. They're trying to convince people to accept Christianity. Much the same as the Quran. Do you accept the Quran? Would you go through the evidence for the Quran? There are 800 million Mohammedans today. You can raise the same thing about whether or not Muhammad's view is reliable.
No,
or whether Joseph Smith in the Book of the Mormon.
He didn't claim to be God and offer this proof. And besides that, there are two other people who weren't believers that Jesus did appear to. His brothers, James and Jude, weren't believers. He appeared to both of them after his resurrection.
This is hearsay.
So he did appear. Well, the eyewitnesses are the ones who heard it and saw it, and they said it. If that's hearsay,
well,
then,
it's like reading books by a disciple of Reverend Moon. Now, a lot of people today are very critical about Reverend Moon. Do you go to the Unification Church to find out what Moon believes and what he does not believe and what he did and did not have?
If I followed your
logic, you'd be very cautious about reading what Reverend Moon wrote. You'd read about what other people in the context at that time wrote. All that you have are the Christian
Paul.
Documents.
Careful, because I've had the key spokesman for Reverend Moon on the program, and so I've done all the research. So let's not bring that up
if
too far.
If anyone who saw the events is disqualified, and anyone who believes it is disqualified, then you should never read a book by any evolutionist and accept any scientific fact in that book because he has an axe to grind.
Well, the point is, I don't take the New Testament as scientific fact. I think it's an expression of belief. It's a product of an oral tradition. The stories probably change. It's based upon hearsay, second-hand and third-hand testimony. It's not direct testimony that can be interpreted in historical terms.
What we just showed you, it was first-hand eyewitness testimony for which there are more manuscripts, more witnesses, more cross-checks, archaeologically supported than any book from the ancient world. So you just, again, wiped out all of ancient history. Let me suggest
that there's a literature of biblical criticism that goes back to at least two centuries, and there are a number of scholars who denied
every
point.
Do you know where that started? Criticism started? It started with Benedict Spinoza in 1670 in his book, Theological Tractatus. Benedict Spinoza was a pantheist naturalist who didn't believe in miracles, and because of his rationalism and anti-supernaturalism, he assumed those miracles
didn't happen, and modern
criticism sprang from that,
which is built on an anti-supernatural bias. I say, go to the Bible, read it with a scientific, open, objective mind. Do not read it through the eyes of faith. Read it as you read any other book. And if you read it as you read any other book, then doubts do creep in on this point.
I would say just the opposite. Go to the Bible with an open mind. Say, what are they saying? Whom are they saying it about? And ask yourself the question, is it true? Is there evidence for it? And you will conclude that Jesus Christ is the Son of God. The Bible says you shall know the truth, and the truth shall set you free. You're interested in freedom as a humanist, and I suggest that you can get true freedom through Jesus Christ.
Well, it's a very nice sermon, and it may be true, but I think that the Bible ought to be reread today. I think it's important that people read the Bible freshly and independently without any theological bias, and I think you ought to read it in the light of archaeology and read it in the light of philology and linguistics and other scientific endeavors at the same time. Right. Read it in the same way you read the Quran.
That's right.
And be skeptical.
And the Quran does. Why do you add "and be skeptical"? Read it and be open to the evidence.
Be open.
Don't read it with a bias against it. Read it, be open to the evidence. I look at the Quran, I've read it, and I'm open. Well, Muhammad claimed to be a prophet.
Okay.
He didn't claim to be God. Muhammad didn't die and rise from the dead. He didn't
claim
to.
Muhammad
that
he
didn't fulfill prophecy.
He claimed that he had
make,
a visitation.
He
claimed that you're really close-minded and biased about the Quran. You should have an open mind about it.
That's what it says.
He claimed to have had a visitation from Gabriel in the cave at Hirja, north of Mecca. He was the only one that had this visitation from Gabriel. It was uncorroborated. On the basis of that, he gave these marvelous statements that became the Quran. And there's something like 1 billion Mohammedans in the world who now accept the Quran as true.
Hey, now, Paul, can I jump in right there? The thing is, if you have, you got two competing world systems like...
Yes.
Muslim religion and the Christian religion. In the Quran, Muhammad is told to repent seven times. You also have the fact that in the Quran, Jesus Christ, it was said, he didn't die on the cross, and he didn't come forth from the dead. Christianity says he did die on the cross and he did come forth from the dead. One or the other is right. They both can't be right at the same time saying contradictory things. Now, how would you come to a conclusion which one is right?
Well, the question is, what is the evidence for the resurrection?
I agree with you.
Resurrection? It may have been that Jesus did, if Jesus existed, some people have denied that he existed, but I assume that he did. If he existed, he may not have died on the cross. He may only have swooned. He may have been taken into the cave and then disappeared and not necessarily had been resurrected.
Dr. Geist,
not necessarily had died.
Well, the swoon theory is long since swooned, but Jesus did die on the cross. We know it because he was on the cross from 9 o'clock in the morning till just before sunset. He had
six hours.
Wounds. He was on the cross from 9 o'clock. I know you have to read it again, because if you don't
late
know that,
afternoon.
He was on at 9 o'clock in the morning. Read Mark's account, and you'll see. He had wounds in his hands, wounds in his feet. They put a spear in his side. He gave a death cry. He said he was dying. The Roman soldiers verified his death. He was wound up in 100 pounds of
spices
and things and put in a grave and was there, and it was sealed up. If ever anyone was dead, he was dead.
Pontius Pilate was surprised when they heard he was
dead.
Pontius double-checked it, in fact. Yeah. He double-checked it to make sure after all of that, on top of it. And Jesus Christ rose. Read Stroud's book on the physiological causes of Christ's death. If you ever had an infallible proof from a distance that Jesus died because of the blood and water came out of his side, you have it in that book. And if you're open-minded, I suggest you take a look at it.
Well, there are other people who have suggested that we don't have sufficient evidence to say that he did die, that he may merely have fainted and risen in the tomb.
Anybody
and then,
can
and,
suggest
and then left.
Anything, but the evidence shows...
What would be
died.
Sufficient evidence,
but,
Paul?
Well, I think sufficient evidence would be by, not necessarily propagandists, but by objective or impartial people. The problem is that this is long far gone. It's very difficult now to corroborate these facts.
The claims that are made
against natural events. Now, usually if people do die, usually they do not come back to life. Therefore, if we're to accept the fact of resurrection, then we would need very strong evidence indeed, and not merely the evidence as a product of an oral tradition that is passed down by religion. We would need corroboration. I don't think we have that in regard to
the
Testament.
We have about 2 minutes left, Norman.
Well, we now have corroboration. We have numerous witnesses who saw him on at least 10 different occasions over a 40-day period of time. They stuck their finger in his hand. They stuck their hand in his side. He ate fish. They felt his flesh and bones. He taught them. He performed miracles. He transformed them from cowards to courageous men who went out and preached the resurrection and converted the very people in the very city, in the very area in which this had all happened, not hundreds of years later, but just 40 days later. That's good evidence.
All right, we're going to come back next week. We're going to have questions and answers from the audience. I hope that you'll join us. We'll continue on secular humanism. We're getting down to questions from the audience, but I'd like to start you off on one that we haven't approached anywhere before, and that is the fact that if you do leave out God, as the Humanist Manifesto suggests that man, modern man, ought to do, it seems like you have a real tough problem motivating anybody. And I know you've written a book on that, but let me see if I can outline it here. And that is that to motivate people, for example, let me just give you one of the things that you say in the manifesto too. You say, the commitment to all humankind is the highest commitment of which we are capable. But the question is, what's the motivation for a person to commit himself to all of mankind when this is true? Since a person's life in this world, according to the secular humanist philosophy, is his basic tangible value, any action which threatens or does not advance this possession would seem to be irrational. Why should I ever set any moral obligation above the ends that serve my own self-interest? How could anybody challenge me to perform something self-sacrificing ever if I believe that I am the product of chance plus time plus the impersonal, and I got here by accident, and all that there is my existence? Why should I care about anything else, Paul?
Well, I teach moral philosophy at the university. This is the basic question of Western ethics. Humanism is the oldest intellectual tradition in Western civilization. It goes back to the Greeks and the Romans through the Renaissance, up to the development of modern science to the present. And one of the basic themes is this question of moral obligation. And the great philosophers from Socrates, Plato, Aristotle, Kant, John Stuart Mill, down to the present have raised that question over and over again. I think life is meaningful, that it's full of adventure and goals and plans, that human beings could lead a significant life here and now and be concerned with human justice, the world community, and other fellow men and women on this planet without necessarily believing in God. So it's a mistake to think that only those people who believe a certain religion are moral, when indeed the whole history of the West and of other civilizations indicates people have had other moral purposes.
I understand where you're coming from. I don't believe it, but I understand it. And let me see how you would argue then with somebody who take the opposite position. The French philosopher, Julien Offray de la Mettrie, put it this way. Let us conclude boldly then, you know, using that we are an accident here, chance plus time plus the impersonal, and voila, here we are. Let us conclude boldly under that kind of a system that man is a machine, and that in the whole universe there is but a single substance with various modifications. Now, if man is a machine who's here by accident, there was no intelligence that got him here. There was no reason for him to be here. He just got here. He is as valuable as one of the Supreme Court justices said. There is no difference between a man, a baboon, and a rock, and a drop of water, because they all got here the same way. And there's no reason for them to get here except by accident they all showed up. So now how do you motivate that person?
I don't know who the Supreme Court justice who said that, but you must surely be quoting him out of context. But I do find human beings are different than rocks and baboons. We've created human civilization. We believe in the arts. We believe in creating a good society. We're motivated by science and literature, by shared experience, by the moral decencies. It's not necessarily true that the only people who are moral and fulfill the good life are the people who accept a specific religious point of view. I think life is very meaningful. And the plan and project of man is to create the good life. It's an adventure. It's full of joy.
Here's what Oliver Wendell Holmes.
People have found the same thing.
Here's what Oliver Wendell Holmes actually said. Supreme Court Justice from 1902 to 1932 said, "I see no reason for attributing to man a significant difference in kind from that which belongs to a baboon or a grain of sand. I believe that our personality is a cosmic ganglion. Just as when certain rays meet and cross, there is white light at the meeting point. That is all."
Well, human personality, yes, I believe human personality is cherished, it's precious. I believe in human individuality and creativity. What? And these are, and men and women have dreamed and believed in this throughout the whole history of humankind.
Okay.
And they've built cities, and they've climbed mountains, and they've explored the universe, and they've developed poetry and art and music. What's the problem? I mean, that's all part of the adventure of living, without worrying about salvation, about the afterlife, or without only preparing but what's going to happen after you die? Live here and now. That's the secular morality.
Okay.
Live here and now and create the
good
life.
So man doesn't need God any while. There's really no need he has for God.
Well, I think God is invented in the image of man. If lions had God, they would be lion-like in character. Some people apparently think that they need religious belief and need God. I don't. I think I can lead a good life without that myth.
Dr. Geisler, do you agree with that?
Well, I agree with Paul that you can be moral without being religious, and you can be moral without believing in God. The problem is you can't justify being moral. Let me illustrate that. Many humanists have many wonderful values, including Paul. They're for tolerance, they're for freedom, they're for peace in the world, they're against Hitler, they're against the Holocaust, you know. They have many wonderful values, so they believe in moral prescriptions. The problem is, how can you have an absolute moral prescription, or even an ultimate moral prescription, anything worthy of committing yourself to as a religion, as many humanists believe it is, if you don't have an ultimate moral prescriber? You don't have laws without legislators and prescriptions without prescribers. And yet the very same humanists who really make an ultimate commitment to these moral principles don't believe there's an ultimate prescriber to make the moral principles possible. So they can believe in them without there being a God, but they can't justify believing them without there being a God.
On the contrary, you're saying they're illogical at that point, then irrational.
Yes.
Well, Norman, you know the philosophers have debated this point for 2,500 years, and they disagree with you on that point. They talk about the autonomy of ethics. Ethics grows out of human experience. There's a development of moral awareness, moral appreciation, a moral conscience. You can test moral judgments by their consequences in human life. I mean, there is such a thing as moral wisdom and moral growth. I don't see where you have to bring in outside force to support this.
Didn't G.E. Moore in The Naturalistic Fallacy prove that just what you're saying isn't possible to come up with an ultimate?
Well, I don't know that you need an ultimate. I wouldn't say that ethics is derived from an ultimate principle. I do think that there are moral principles that I believe in. They're general moral principles, and they grow out of human experience and human life.
Okay, so then if you don't have an absolute, how would you argue with Hitler, who said what we really need to do is get rid of 5 million Jews?
Well, I think, of course, that Hitler was wrong, and I'm against genocide.
But on what basis, Paul, if there's no absolutes?
Because of the horrible consequences of cruelty and terror and murder of innocent human beings. One doesn't need absolutes to oppose that.
But Marquis de Sade took the evolutionary theory and said, if the strongest survive, then I'll go around and beat women. So there we got sadism out of that. And he was absolutely logical according to your philosophy.
Why is he wrong?
He
wasn't logical. No, not at all. Of course, I reject that. But, you know, in the name of God, men and women have created infamies, and they've performed every kind of cruelty. If you believe with the fatherhood of God, if you believe in the fatherhood of God, as the Mohammedans, you can believe in polygamy. They believe in the fatherhood of God. Or the Mormons believed in the fatherhood of God and believed in
polygamy. But I can see their motivation. They're wrong in their belief, but I can see their motivation having an ultimate reference point. But I don't see any reference point
saying. You take the religious point of view. You can take the religious point of view, and people have deduced exactly opposite principles. Christians believe in abortion, and they're against abortion in the name of God.
Okay,
they believe in divorce, and they're against divorce. Morality, it seems to me, is a data of human experience that should be examined in its own terms without presupposing these assumptions.
Okay, Norman, you just got done with a great research project on the area of abortion. Let's speak and use that as an example. The area of abortion, some Christians agree and disagree. What would you say?
Well, here's a good example that I think if a humanist were truly a humanist, he'd be pro-life, because we know medically life begins at conception. There's no medical doubt about the fact that a fertilized ovum is a 100% genetic human being. Its sex is determined. There's no doubt about the fact that the babies that are being killed today with fingerprints, heartbeat, blood type, fully function, are human beings. And I think the humanists someday are going to sit around in smoke-filled rooms and say to themselves, we shouldn't have let those evangelicals grab that pro-life thing. We're humanists. We're for human life, and yet we're only for it after it begins at birth, not after it begins at conception. I think the travesty, Hitler only killed 6 million Jews. We've killed 18 million unborn human beings in America in the last 13 years. I think humanists ought to all repent and get on the pro-life side, like Bernard Nathanson, who is a Jewish atheist, did and wrote a book, Aborting America, after he had personally killed 60,000 of them. He got dehumanized because that moral principles finally got through to him. A moral absolute came through to him, and he said, this is morally wrong.
Norman, on this point, there are liberal Christians and liberal Jews and liberal Catholics, indeed, who don't agree with you on abortion. and do not believe that the women should not have freedom of choice. My point was simply that even if you believe in God, there are differences of opinion in the moral domain, and believe in conviction that a human personality does not begin until later. No, I don't think that abortion should be resorted to as a method of birth control. I think it ought to be a reflective decision of a woman. On the other hand, I wouldn't deny her the right of free choice
but
at Paul, some point after
you base your
process.
Beliefs as a humanist on scientific evidence. It's not a matter of religious belief. I'm not concerned about their religious belief. The scientific facts are that they're human from the point of conception. So I don't think somebody's religious belief should be imposed upon these innocent human beings. They have a right to their belief, but they don't have a right to kill innocent
people.
Well,
I thought you were drawing this on the basis, I thought that you were arguing against abortion on religious ground. You're now doing it on
science. No, I'm arguing on moral, factual grounds.
Independent of religion.
That's right.
Okay, I don't disagree.
Scientifically, it's a
okay.
human being.
That's my point, that you can argue moral questions independent of religion. There's an autonomy of moral decision making.
Well,
but in regard to abortion, I didn't think John did, but in regard to abortion, Norman, on this point, I think that what you have at conception is a fetus or a conceptus and not a living human being or a living human, not a human personality,
But personality
which
is a philosophical, religious term about
yes.
which people yes. debate. There is no debate about the fact of being 100% genetically human being, and we got to stick with the scientific
facts. But then you get into these great moral tragedies. What would you do if a woman is raped? Would you then say in the first week after the conception that there ought not to be an abortion?
Ask Ethel Waters about that. Her mother was raped.
Well, what would you say about that?
I would say that rape is a terrible crime, but we ought to punish the guilty rapist, not the innocent
All
man.
Right, but what do you do? Then you mean in the first week you would compel this woman to give birth? On what basis can you do that? I mean, this is an invasion of her body, and it seems to me a woman has a right of freedom of choice, and you can make a moral case that women ought to be permitted to have an abortion under such conditions.
A woman has a right of freedom of choice, but she does not have the right to freely kill another innocent
okay.
human being, and it is a scientific fact that it's another innocent human being
well,
in her womb.
It's not an innocent human
She doesn't have the right
being.
To kill it.
It's a fetus.
It's a human being.
It's a fetus.
A medical, genetic, scientific
and
fact.
It's not
that
innocent
it's human.
Because
well, did
she,
it sin?
Well,
it has a, you don't believe in original
wait,
sin.
Wait, you say
you?
No. But surely the fetus has invaded her body. It's not entirely innocent. If someone came here and plugged into you, you say, and said, well, you're going to stay in this position for 9 months.
What you're saying is that she has a right to kill
you.
It because it's getting her food from her than any mother after the baby
well,
is born has
I mean,
the right to
you know,
kill it
these things
still
are,
getting her
a,
food from her.
In a democratic, free, open, pluralistic society, these are arguable questions. And it's very difficult to say under what point does the fetus become a human being with
well,
rights.
Well, it's not difficult at all. Science has pointed. There was a subcommittee hearing recently in Washington, and virtually every scientist that came there, including the famous world geneticist Lejeune from France, said that life begins at conception. That's not what
something,
they're debating about.
Something, well, we're not talking about life. Something begins at conception.
We're talking about
it's
human
conceptus,
life.
It's conceptus or it's a fetus, but there's a developmental process. Now, I agree that later in the pregnancy, I would not have an abortion unless the life of the mother is endangered. And the woman ought to have an abortion early, let's
but
say in the first
no more human
trimester
later.
Or the second trimester.
There is no new genetic information added after the
there,
point of
there
conception.
Is, there is a developmental process.
There is no new genetic information added.
Well, but the fetus grows as it's nourished by the mother.
Well, you grow after you're born. Can we kill people because they're
small? Of course,
small?
You know, you can argue. a fetus is not a person. That's the
well,
point.
Now, wait a minute. Person
I mean,
is defined by what?
The fetus is a potential person. It's as if you would argue that one ought not to practice contraception because the sperm or the egg is a potential person the
Who
same
said
sense.
A fetus
well,
is not a person? Philosophers and theologians. I'm not talking about religion and philosophy. I'm talking about cold, hard scientific
later.
Facts that you
it's
like
not cold,
as a humanist.
It's not cold, hard scientific facts. On this point, a moral attitude is applied to the developmental process.
It's not a question
process.
Of moral attitude. I think if we took a survey, Paul, wouldn't you agree that everyone, 98 to 99% of the country would answer this question in the affirmative. Do you believe it's wrong to kill an innocent human being? Right? Wouldn't you say 98% of the country believe it's wrong to kill an innocent human being?
Yes, now, of course. But the question,
okay, well,
definition is whether the fetus is an innocent human being.
That's right. Let me finish. Then there's only really one question left, and that's a factual question. Is a fertilized ovum a human being? And when 23 chromosomes from a male sperm unite with 23 chromosomes from a female ovum, it is a scientific fact that that 46 chromosome
potential.
Is a human being.
It's
not potential.
It is potential.
It's a human life with great potential. It is not a potential life.
Well, it is not fully developed as a potential human
Neither
being.
Neither is you a four-year-old
you could argue
fully
that
developed.
You could argue against birth control, as many devout Catholics have, because either the sperm
We're not
or egg
about birth
are potential
control.
Human beings. They use the same argument, that therefore this is a sin to do that. So at what point do you split the developmental process and say, does human personality begin and
We're
does it not begin? In any case, it seems to me women
about.
Have rights, and men should not simply impose their standards on women and say you must carry this fetus to term, no matter what, even if it's a product of rape,
Paul,
even if it's a deformed fetus as a
when you're talking about imposing
even if your life is
your moral standard on someone else and your religious beliefs. That unborn, innocent human being is having someone else impose their standards on them and not allowing them to live. I think that's immoral.
Well, but it's an open question. There are many people who disagree with you that that is an innocent human being.
All right, let me jump in here.
Definition.
And that is that
your definition.
In Roe versus Wade, I want to pull a point out of what you're talking about here. Abortion was legalized because the state saw no reason to protect the life of the unborn. They redefined personhood there. They didn't look at the scientific evidence.
That's not true, John. The Supreme Court said that people will disagree theologically and metaphysically about when human life or human personality begins.
The court says the state has no interest or right to protect it.
But then they said because honest people disagree on this point, therefore the individual ought to decide whether or not she wants to have an abortion
they said
or not
because
have
it's not
abortion.
Of sufficient value to the state. And what I want to draw out of this, Paul, is the fact is that when you have a secular state like you're talking about with your values that do not have any absolutes, that we get caught in this kind of thing that personhood can be defined just like it was in Hitler's time, that when you have relative values and you have no absolute, you have no God over the law, the Supreme Court can take a check among themselves and say this is what we're going to decide. There is no standard.
Well, I think that what the Supreme Court was arguing for was the principle of freedom of conscience and liberty of conscience, and it recognized that in our democratic society, people will disagree.
All 50 states
and it therefore
had already passed
afforded
the law
to women
forbidding
the right
it.
Of freedom of choice for those who wished an abortion.
All 50 states had already passed a law forbidding it, and it was only by an injunction of the Supreme Court on their highly thrones up there that decided that the whole United States was wrong.
What Paul is saying is right. The Supreme Court said the right of privacy comes over the right to life. And that's absolutely absurd. You don't have the right privately to kill children in your basement. If it's a human being, the right of privacy never takes precedence over the right to life.
The right of privacy is the right of a woman over her own body.
But a fetus is not part of her body. A fetus could be male, she's female, has its own blood type, has its own brainwave from 40 days on. You take a black embryo and transplant it into a white womb, and that woman will have a black baby. It's not part of her body. It's an individual human being of its own. And the last time the Supreme Court said somebody wasn't a person was in 1857 when they said blacks weren't persons. And it took 11 years to reverse that. It's time we reverse it.
The Supreme Court did not say... The Supreme Court neither affirmed nor denied whether or not a fetus was a person. It said this was an open question.
That's wrong,
what it
Paul.
Did affirm was the,
All you
was,
have to do is
the
read
defense
it.
Of women against the
Roe
effort.
Way.
I have read it very carefully. It was a defense of women against the effort by men or the state to impose
anybody out
pregnancy.
There to go down to your library and get Roe
reproduction
versus Wade
freedom.
And read it, and you'll see that what he said is wrong. The Supreme Court said you are not a person before.
All right, we got some questions right here.
Yeah, I address this to Paul. In my belief as a Christian, I'm a Christian, I direct this to you concerning death and what happens when you die. In hearing your views as a skeptic, who is not sure, I guess that's what that means, if I as a Christian am wrong and you are right, I've lost nothing and I die and cease to exist as you. But if you're wrong and I'm right, you've lost everything. How do you feel about that? And more importantly to you, is it worth it?
Well, that's Pascal's famous wager that you've offered. I can find no evidence for the existence of an afterlife, even independently of religion. In religion, the belief in salvation is an article of faith. People hope that they will continue to live after the existence of the body. But spending years in research and ghost hunting and examining the evidence for life after life, I don't find sufficient evidence to support that claim. Therefore, it's an idle gesture. Now, I can turn the wager around that if God doesn't exist and this is merely an illusion, then much of what you do is a waste of time. What you ought to try to do is try to build the best society we can live in here and now and do whatever you can to make life meaningful today.
The problem with that, Paul, is that the very people that you quote constantly are constantly concerning the fact of the need for God and the quest for God and meaning of life, I think are the strongest testimonies in evidence that you're wrong. For example, Sartre said, "I needed God." Or Camus, "Nothing can discourage the appetite for divinity in the heart of man." Or Nietzsche, "I hold up before myself the images of Dante and Spinoza," who Geiser was talking about before, "who were better at accepting the lot of solitude. And in the end, all those who somehow still had a God for company. My life now consists in the wish that it might be otherwise, and that somebody might make my truths appear incredible to me."
Well, but all three rejected belief in God. I affirm you can lead an authentic life, and you can find life rich. There is a kind of fullness of existence in the plans and projects that we create. Life is an adventure. Why need of an illusion?
Well, one of the secular humanists that I would be very proud of it, that wrote in your book, one of the essays in your book on moral problems in contemporary society, H.J. Blackmun, formerly director of the British Humanist Association, said that the problem as he saw it was the pointlessness of it all.
Really?
I
think you may be quoting Blackham out of context, because Blackham, and I heard Blackham speak, read much of what he said, that Blackham has argued continuously that life is full of meaning, that there are points, and that the fact that one doesn't believe in God does not deaden the appetite or the lust for living. On the contrary.
Well, I could go on with the list. Maybe
great
Dr.
artists
you want
and
to
scientists and poets and writers
area.
Have affirmed the opposite.
Well, just let me add one thought. In my research, my doctoral research in this very point, I found that atheists had a need for God and admitted it. Sartre did, Camus did. Walter Kaufman said, "Man is a God-intoxicated ape." Camus, the quote that you said there, they admitted it. But what they were saying is this: "I have a need for God, but he doesn't exist." Now, that's like saying, "I am starving, but there's no food anywhere." I can understand someone saying, "I'm starving, I didn't find food." But to say, "I'm starving and there's no food anywhere, don't look for it. I'm thirsty and there's no water anywhere, don't look for it," that's cruel. And to say, "You need God, but ha-ha, there isn't a God, don't look for it," is also cruel. At least you ought to take a look at the evidence.
Then human personality would really be a disease, because you have these longings and you can't fulfill it.
Well, not everybody has those longings. None of my friends have those longings. Some people do.
Well,
not everybody
there's a reason
does.
For that. These people we quoted were just atheists, and there's a reason some atheists don't have those longings. And it's spelled out pretty clearly in Romans chapter 1 and verse 18 in the Bible. It said they turned from the God who was there, and God gave them over to a reprobate mind. You can get to the point that after you reject the truth, then you no longer have those longings, but they killed the longings that were initially there.
Question.
Dr. Geisler, did you reason your way to faith in God? And if not, can you expect Dr. Kurtz to do the same?
As a matter of fact, I did. I did not come from a Christian home, and I had to reason my way through this myself, and I studied philosophy, and I studied history, and I came to the conclusion, as many others who weren't rooted in Christian homes, that the evidence is stronger for Christianity, historical evidence and scientific evidence for God than for any other belief system. So I committed myself to that, and I haven't found in 30 years of continual research after that point anything to disrupt that, only further things to confirm it.
Mr. Kurtz, don't you believe that your real problem is that you don't want an answer to a holy, righteous God?
I don't want an answer to a holy, righteous God. You know, I have no fear if God exists and I'm brought to the judgment day, and he says, and I'm called into account. People say, "What happens at the judgment day?" I said, I would have no fear, because I would say to God, "You didn't give me any evidence." And if man is rational and created in God's image, then I guess God would respect that.
Norman?
Well, my only response is, he gave the evidence, but you have to open your eyes to see it.
It seems like Paul preached that the very evidence was the resurrection, which you denied, that God will judge the world by one man rising from the dead and acts.
He didn't give objective, cooperative, independent evidence.
Question.
My question is, Dr. Kurtz, I've read your books and enjoyed them, and I just wanted to give you the opportunity to say a little more about what humanism has contributed to our society.
Oh, I thought I was in the arena being thrown to the lions, and here's one person who's going to join, coming to the arena with me. Well, I think that humanism is a positive, I appreciate your question, because I think humanism is a positive moral point of view, and there are great figures in the history of Western civilization who have been humanists and have contributed immeasurably, whether it's Mark Twain or Thomas Edison or Margaret Sanger or Michelangelo or Beethoven, or you go through the whole history, or Freud, right down. I mean, you find these people who are concerned with the human condition, concerned with furthering the well-being of human beings, and that's what humanism is, an effort to improve the human condition, to ameliorate a better life here and now, to solve human problems by using intelligence and science and reason as best we can. And I'm really surprised and dismayed at the fact that humanists are attacked and criticized because they want to use human intelligence and they want to contribute to the good life. And people say, if you don't accept my religion, you're damned. And I say that there are many people who don't accept your religion and still are good citizens and good persons.
Paul, you know what? Historically, I guess the reason some Christians, some people wish there'd be more, but in 61, the secular humanist doctrine was recognized as a religion by the Supreme Court. In 62, the Supreme Court said that state-required devotional prayers were banned from the schools. In 63, devotional Bible reading was forbidden in the schools. In 68, laws against teaching evolution were ruled unconstitutional in the Arkansas trial. In 1980, the Supreme Court said that posting the Ten Commandments in the classroom is unconstitutional. And in 1982, a law mandating the teaching of creation with evolution was banned in Arkansas. Are you legislating your morality down Christians' throats?
You're listening to The John Ankerberg Show. If you would like to have today's broadcast on audio CD, it is available for just $8. You may order it right now by calling our toll-free line at 1-800-805-3030. That's 1-800-805-3030. Just ask for offer R15. You may also order it at our website at johnankerberg.org. At the end of our program, Dr. Ankerberg will share with you about how you may order all 6 half-hour programs in this series. But now, let's return to today's program.
Are you legislating your morality down Christians' throats?
I would hope not. You know, I think this great country is based upon the First Amendment, and that's the separation of church and state, and that's the notion that the state shall not intervene in religion. And I think that the Supreme Court's rulings are all an effort to interpret it, the views of Jefferson and Madison and the great founders of this great republic, who incidentally were humanists and deists and believed in freedom of conscience and believed that our society ought not to establish a religion. Now, it seems to me the great virtue of America has been that we've not had the fanaticism and we've not had the religious wars, and that belief and unbelief have flourished in this country because of that. And I deplore the efforts in recent years to bridge this basic principle of the separation of church and state. I think the Supreme Court decisions in this regard have been an effort to support the First Amendment.
John, I think it's just the opposite. This great country began with these great words: "We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights. Among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness." There are at least 3 great principles in there: a Creator, man was created, and certain moral absolutes. The Supreme Court has ruled that you cannot teach those 3 things in the public school. Humanists have superimposed their morality by way of the Supreme Court so that you cannot even teach the principles of the Declaration in American schools. That is not freedom.
No, that's not true. The schools do teach the Declaration of Independence. All the students know
the
about it.
The truths of the Declaration
and,
of Independence.
Well, truths.
Creator, creation, and God-given moral absolutes have been ruled unconstitutional by the Supreme Court.
They've not been ruled unconstitutional.
What the
Supreme Court has said
have.
Is that the schools should not indoctrinate for religion. You can teach about
religion. But
they're
indoctrinated
religion,
in humanist teach, views
you
that
should
say
teach
there is no creator,
American
no
history.
Creation, and no supernatural. You can indoctrinate in those views. You just can't indoctrinate
well,
in those
but
Christian
that's the,
views.
But we live under the Constitution. Now, the Declaration of Independence is crucial. We all believe in it. It was written by Jefferson.
You believe,
but the concept,
in it? You believe
the,
there's a creator? Man was created?
No, I don't believe.
Moral absolutes?
I believe in the Declaration of Independence against tyranny, against the established Church of England.
But these truths are self-evident, it says. And what's self-evident, you don't believe.
Well, I don't know that they're self-evident, but I believe in the right of free conscience of life and liberty in the pursuit of happiness. But we live under the Constitution. And the Bill of Rights and the First Amendment.
And the Declaration of Independence is unconstitutional.
But now, the Declaration of Independence was written by Jefferson, who was against any tyranny over the mind of man and believed in religious liberty.
And, said,
and that was fundamental.
And I challenge you to go to Washington, D.C. and stand in front of Jefferson's figure and look over the pond at the White House and look up on the granite and see what he said. He said, God who gave us life, gave us liberty. Can a nation endure when we have neglected that these liberties are a gift of God? That's what Jefferson believed.
Jefferson also believed that the state ought not to intervene and that the state ought not to proclaim a religion, and he believed in religious liberty.
That's exactly right, and we believe that too, Paul.
Okay.
We think the state should not intervene and say that the only thing you can teach in the public school is no creator, no creation, and no God-given moral absolutes. That's intervening and superimposing your humanist religion down our throats.
I think
that's
a libel against
wrong.
The school teachers of America, who are loyal Americans. Many of them are religious and believe in God. They represent a wide range of opinion. And to say, to blame the school teachers and to say that these things are being forbidden, I think is
I'm not
totally
blaming the
mistaken.
School teachers. I'm blaming the Supreme Court.
Well,
those poor school teachers who would like to do something, they have their hands tied. They can't even post the Ten Commandments on a bulletin board. They could put up your secular humanist manifesto on the bulletin board, but they can't put the Ten Commandments up. Is that fair?
They've not. Well, I don't think that they posted
that
the secular
fair?
Humanist bulletin
is
on the bulletin
fair?
Board. I don't
they
think
could.
I don't think American teachers are humanists.
You're not answering my question.
I don't think that one should be. I don't think that they should post the Humanist Manifesto too on the bulletin board.
They can. Though.
I don't know that they can. It seems to me that one ought not to be allowed to argue for religion or against religion. Either atheism.
I thought you said humanism wasn't a religion.
Okay, but either atheism or religious or theism at the same time. The point is that the school should be neutral, and either religion or non-religion shouldn't be taught in the schools.
That's exactly right. They should be neutral, and they're not neutral when the only things you can teach are the basic premises of secular humanism.
Well, that's not true.
Let me finish.
That's
and you true. Can't teach the basic premises of the Declaration of Independence. That's hardly neutral.
Well, I think you've caricatured what is going on. I think you've maligned the teachers. I think our school system is an excellent school system.
I malign the Supreme Court.
I think
Court.
The curriculum and the schools of America have created a great nation, that our students are benefiting from that. These efforts now to attack the schools and to impose religious dogma on the schools, it seems to me, will erode education.
Exactly right. And the only religious dogma you can teach in the schools right now is secular humanist religious dogma, and that's got to change.
Can I jump in here, too?
Not a religious dogma.
Let me jump in here, too, and that is that one of the men that signed the Manifesto 2 with you, Paul, said this concerning secular state of our schools. Okay, he says, I think that the most important factor moving us toward a secular society has been the educational factor. This is Paul Blanchard again. Our schools may not teach Johnny to read properly, but the fact that Johnny is in school until he is 16 tends to lead toward the elimination of religious superstition. The average American child now acquires a high school education, and this militates against Adam and Eve and all the other myths of alleged history. Now, Paul Blanchard was one of the men that signed it, and I think this is what Christians are concerned about, is that by legislating the fact that the beliefs of millions of Christians across the country can't be brought up in the schools in any area, can't pray, can't read the Bible, can't talk about God, can't talk about the facts of science that relate to creation, you have legislated your morality down the throats of millions of Christians, and they think that it's unfair,
first
especially
case,
according to your own principles.
In response to your question, John, I don't agree with Paul Blanchard on that point. The fact that he endorsed the Humanist Manifesto doesn't mean that I accept everything that he says, nor anyone else. But, you know, this is an open society. Surely Christians have every opportunity to express their point of view. There's a free press. There are free churches. I think religion is probably more vigorous here than almost anywhere else. If you begin to establish a church by allowing the church to express itself through governmental institutions, I mean, why not in the firehouse? Why not in the town hall? Why not open up all of the institutions of government to allow religion to interfere? Okay, you say you're nodding. I don't know that agree if you agree or disagree. You're then establishing a religion, you say. And that's contrary to the First Amendment.
You're just opening
contrary
up the fact
to
having
what the
a discussion
Constitution
about
is based on.
Aren't you making a differentiation between the fact if I have a discussion about religion and belief that you ought to believe this religion?
Well, I think that we ought to teach about religion in the schools. I think
we can't
we
even
are.
Mention it, Paul.
Of course you mention it. I think anyone who's taken a history course has read about the history of religion in the schools. Anyone who takes a sociology
creation
course.
Science.
Anyone who takes a philosophy course. Of course you can learn about religion.
How about
students
creation
learn
science?
About religion. What you cannot do is indoctrinate for a religious belief. That's contrary to the spirit of the pluralistic society.
Dr. Geisler,
in
the Arkansas trial, you spoke to this very fact of concerning the difference between teaching religion and teaching facts, as well as then talk to the second question of the fact of what would you suggest Christians do in a society where now we are saying, like in Los Angeles, where the state there said that Bible studies had to be zoned and you couldn't have them in your home, and then it had to be revoked. But the whole society is going that direction, that they're going to tell us where you can think and talk about these topics. Now, this is America.
Well, see, here's the problem. If it's one of our beliefs, by definition, for a secular humanist, it's religious and can't be taught. If it's one of their beliefs, by definition, it isn't religious and can be taught. You talk about heads I win and tails you lose. You talk about sophisticated intellectual bigotry. That's it. Secondly, the Declaration of Independence had three basic principles: God, man created in the image of God, and moral absolutes. Humanists believe exactly the opposite: no God, no man created in the image of God, and no moral absolute. So you have three religious beliefs by Judeo-Christian tradition, three by humanism, which is called a religion and recognized as religion. Now, here's what the Supreme Court said. You can't teach these three. What does that mean? The only thing you can teach are the religious beliefs of secular humanism. If that's not establishing secular humanism, I don't know what is.
Well, it's not establishing secular humanism, because you can teach science and literature and the arts and philosophy and history and sociology and everything else. You open to the world of knowledge, and you teach about religion. What you don't teach, you don't try to establish a specific religion in the United States. America includes Buddhists and Hindus and Jews and Mormons and non-believers and humanists. This is the beauty of this country. It's a pluralistic country in which every point of view thrives.
Alexander,
and the state should not be used to impose one point of view.
Going toward a secular state, does it bother you when you hear a person that came out of a secular state, like Alexander Solzhenitsyn, who in receiving the Templeton Prize stated, "If I were asked today to formulate as concisely as possible the main cause of the ruinous revolution that swallowed up some 60 million of our people, I could not put it more accurately than to repeat, men have forgotten God. That's why all this has happened."
Andrei Zakharov, who is a secular humanist and who signed Humanist Manifesto II and the Secular Humanist Declaration, also is opposed to the tyranny in the Soviet Union.
Okay, give us
so
a 30-second...
So if one believes
second...
in freedom and democracy, one doesn't necessarily have to believe in God. You can believe in God and believe in dictatorship, believe in the divine right of kings, believe in oligarchy. Democracy is too vital in this country. We believe in freedom. We believe in an open democratic society. We believe in a society in which religious bigotry does not prevail.
Okay, Dr. Geisler, give us a 30-second... second wrap up here.
Well, America was founded on basic Judeo-Christian principles, and they're the ones that gave secular humanists their right to express their view. Take a humanist, atheist country like Russia and see if there's any real religious freedom for people who don't believe in that. Actually, humanists ought to be in favor of these Judeo-Christian principles, because they're the ones that give them their right to practice their humanism. At the same time, I don't think their ideals are being implemented, because they're not giving us our right to express our views in the public schools.
Gentlemen, I just want to say thank you tonight. I asked you to share from your heart and to get involved with it, and I think that you have done that. And I appreciate, Paul, that you would come and express the views of the secular humanists, and Dr. Geisler, that you would represent Orthodox Christianity. Thank you, gentlemen, very much.
Thank you.